This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
When this pandemic first began, we heard from national officials. We heard from local officials. We heard from media commentators. Probably heard from me at some point. Does anybody remember the clarion call that everybody said we had to take our direction from when this pandemic began? Do you remember? Do you remember what everybody said? Three little words. What were they? Follow the science. Follow the science. Now, of course, like most slogans that get boiled down to three words, like most big ideas that get boiled down to three-word phrases, that's easier said than done. Because when you have something that's called the novel coronavirus, it's novel. We don't have a lot of experience dealing with it. So the science can say conflicting things and the science can say different things. But here's my question. When did we decide, as a city, as a state, as a country, when did we decide to abandon that philosophy of following the science? Because it's clearly not what we're doing anymore. Clearly. The CDC on Friday, and I had this on my list for yesterday. I'm sorry I didn't get to mention it yesterday. But the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, who kind of has been setting the advisory guidelines for the cities and the states to follow when it comes to a lot of this stuff. And they seem to be pretty cautious. They didn't rush to have everybody, even once you're unvaccinated, walk around without masks. They didn't rush to have vaccinated people socializing with other vaccinated people too soon. They've been pretty cautious. I think we can agree on that. So on Friday, CDC officials called on school districts to set policies that enable full reopening of in-person facilities. Now, there was nobody cheering louder when I saw that news on Friday than me. That's what we need. I mean, the children that have been in school for the last 2 years, and I hope they're all enjoying their summer vacation now, and I hope some of them, as I did when I was a young person, particularly in high school and junior high school, are using the fact that they don't have to be in school tomorrow morning to stay up late and listen to the radio. Big shout out to all of you under 18-year-olds that are doing just that. But the new guidance went further. The new guidance from the CDC advised schools to implement layers of protection, such as testing and contact tracing in lieu of masks, or 3 feet of distance between students who can get vaccinated starting at age 12. Those recommendations, the CDC recommendations, that's national, echo the recommendations made by the New York State Department of Health in June. So you have New York State, you have the CDC, the federal government, both saying the same thing. You don't need to have children wearing masks in school. You need to have testing. You need to have contact tracing. You don't need to have children wearing masks in school. Apparently, all this science is lost on New York City's chief science denier, the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, because he came out yesterday and said that, and again, as soon as the governor embarrasses him with something else, I'm sure he'll change his philosophy on this 2 days from now. But New York City's chief science denier, Mayor de Blasio, came out and said all New York City public school students must continue to wear masks in the classroom. That is me banging my head against the console. You know, Richard Bey used to come on television and he used to do that Channel 9 show and he used to run up to the camera and say, where do they find these people? My goodness, what will it take for the mayor to get a clue? The state is saying children don't need to be masked. The federal government is saying that children don't need to be masked. There's a vaccine available for teachers. There's a vaccine available for children over the age of 12. Most children who get the disease don't have any serious health consequences at all. Now, I watched with bated breath as the mayor made this announcement yesterday. And I said, okay, well, he's going to have some really good reason. I thought that for about a second. What's the good reason? This was the mayor of the city of New York and New York City's chief science denier, Bill de Blasio, yesterday.
Wearing the masks is a smart thing to do in schools. We'll keep assessing as we go along, but I think for now it still makes sense.
It still makes sense? Well, why does it still make sense? Was there any explanation of why it still makes sense? So despite the CDC's latest guidance that vaccinated children and teachers can go mask-free, the mayor of New York City said yesterday that you still have to wear a mask, teachers. You still have to wear a mask, children. Your reaction, 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. And what's the reason? For now, we're sticking with the idea that wearing masks is a smart thing to do in schools. We'll keep assessing as we go along, but for now, it still makes sense. Well, then, if we're going to keep assessing, then the mayor should have at least, and I get that we want to be cautious, right? I understand that. This is a serious thing. I'm not trying to make too light of it. But if the mayor says we're going to keep assessing, then he should give the public and give New York City school parents what exactly the criteria will be for doing away with the mask guidance. Is the mask, are we going to do away with the masks once 70% of the population is vaccinated? Are we going to do away with the masks if 80 or 90% of the student body has antibodies? Are we going to do away with the mask if the infection rate is less than 1%? Give us the criteria by which, if we're going to keep assessing, we can do away with this. He said, we've been constantly working with the CDC, but we also, in this case, have been very careful given everything the city's been through. Well, I mean, if you're working, you're not working with the CDC, you're ignoring the CDC. You're not working with the CDC. You might be listening to the CDC. It's like when you're a kid and your parent tells you to do something and you just ignore it. You hear them. But if you're ignoring it, you're not exactly listening. 800-848-WABC. This was New York City's health commissioner, Dr. David Chokshi.
We're going to be reviewing the new guidance carefully, discussing it with our colleagues at the Department of Education with additional information for parents and students in the weeks ahead.
Now, again, I feel kind of bad for Commissioner Chokshi because I've known a lot of people in public life in positions like this. They want to maintain their position so that they can move the needle forward at least a little bit. But they at the same time have to come and be the face of a decision they know makes no sense. And that's the position Commissioner Chokshi is in. But he said a whole lot of nothing in his remarks. Now, you go across the Hudson River and a guy that is showing a little bit of a brain and a little bit of backbone on this issue is, and not that much, but at least a little bit, is the governor of the state of New Jersey, Phil Murphy. And I got to give the governor credit here. This was Governor Murphy yesterday.
We'll continue to monitor it like a hawk. You know, as I said before, unlike putting an HVAC system in, a mask decision, you have the ability, more time on the clock.
So what Governor Murphy and New Jersey have done is there's no mask mandate. They're following the guidance from the CDC. Imagine that. How crazy is that? Follow the science. And Governor Murphy is leaving it up to school districts to come up. If they want masks, they can come up with their own restrictions.
Still digesting the CDC guidance. I'm happy to say that overwhelmingly what they came out with was very consistent with where we were.
Very consistent, not only with where New Jersey is, but with where New York State is. The only place where we live under this cloud of this dome of not having to follow the science, of making up the rules as we go along, irrespective of what the data says, is New York City, Governor Phil Murphy.
we're comfortable with where we are. And by the way, remember, these from the state are recommendations. Any school district has the ability to tweak that based on their local circumstances.
800-848-WABC. You're welcome to comment. 1-800-848-9222. In my view, this is completely reasonable, what Murphy is doing. And it's completely nonsensical what Mayor de Blasio is doing. Murphy is saying, we're going with the CDC guidance. That's the same advice that our experts came up with. Doesn't make sense to have children have to wear a mask in school. So you know what? We're not going to. But this is just recommendations. Ultimately, the people that get to make decisions about school policy are the school districts themselves. And if there's a school district that decides they want to have mask mandates, then go ahead. Let the school district decide that. Now, that is frighteningly reasonable. Frighteningly reasonable. I do not understand what de Blasio is trying to prove here. I don't understand the motivation for this. I don't think like the mayor was one of the people early on that was trying to get kids back in school. He also made this disastrous deal with the teachers union, which kept kids out of school for much longer than they should have been. But I have no doubt that the mayor wants children to have a positive educational experience. And I get that. Sometimes you want to err on the side of caution. But I'll tell you this. Caution to the point of reducing children to the point of being hermetically sealed educational robots is not a healthy thing. It's not a healthy thing for them physically. It's not a healthy thing for them psychologically. And the only thing that de Blasio's behavior is doing is contributing more to the anti-mask hysteria. I don't know if you heard Dr. Peter Mikolos on the Cats at Night program yesterday. Very good interview. But Dr. Mikolos talked with John Catsimatidis and Peter King last night at 5:55. Great interview. You can check out the podcast at WABCradio.com. And Dr. Mikolos said that of almost all the new infections that have come in the last month, at least those that have resulted in hospitalizations, 99% of them are people that have chosen not to get vaccinated. Now, to me, that's a pretty good commercial for vaccination. What de Blasio is doing is the exact opposite of that, because it's got to be a carrot and stick approach. If you say to a parent or a teacher, hey, you get vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask. Great. You'll have children, parents, teachers running to get vaccinated. But if you say, as de Blasio seems to be doing and Commissioner Chokshi seems to be doing, if you say to them, well, vaccinated, schmaccinated, you got the vaccine, tough, you got to wear the mask anyway. Well, why would you go out and get vaccinated? Either the vaccination is your key to freedom and a normal life, or it's not. And in Bill de Blasio's New York City, it's still not. Your reaction, I'd love to hear it. You're welcome to disagree. 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Dave in Manhattan. Hello, Dave.
Frank, Bill de Blasio is a dingleberry on a derriere of the teachers' union. These ill-conceived, silly mandates remind me of Governor Cuomo at the point when the vaccine was being rolled out, who said, no, we're not going to release the vaccine in New York unless and until we have our own decision makers. And Trump said, fine, then I won't give it to you. And what happened? Cuomo caved. This has absolutely nothing to do with science. It has nothing to do with health. Whenever you mix politics with medicine, you get politics. When you mix politics with finance, you get politics. When you mix politics with corruption, you get business as usual.
Well, thank you, Dave. Look, I don't agree with the mayor's approach on this one. I'm not going to call him a dingleberry on the derriere of the teachers union, but, you know, you're entitled to your own opinion. 800-848-WABC, you're welcome to disagree. Norman is in Brooklyn. Hello, Norman.
Yeah, hi, Frank. Listen, I think what de Blasio is just reacting to is our crazy sick kids. To them, the mask represents wokedom, and they like wearing their masks, and he's reacting to those far lefties sitting on the city council.
But so, who in the city council has said that children should continue to wear these masks in school?
Yes, of course. Of course they're going to do that.
No, but who? I said who? Who has?
The people on the city council.
Well, who specifically? Which council members?
Okay, if you put on Channel 25, which I do, you know, I have cable, the speech, people.
Norman, I'm sorry, you're breaking up there, Norman. If you want to try and call back from a landline, I'd be happy to talk with you. Look, the mayor has had no problem ignoring the will of the city council, and I'd be pretty surprised if that was the rationale for this. I think the mayor's just afraid to make a wrong decision. I think that's what it comes down to. And I think it comes down to throwing away this philosophy that we had at the beginning of the pandemic, which of following the science. I think the mayor was criticized for following the advice of his head of Health and Hospitals Corporation initially. And the mayor was criticized for what some people considered a less stringent approach early on, in contrast to places like Maryland and Ohio and California, and certainly in one county in California. So I'd be happy to hear your comments, your thoughts. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Coming up at 1:30, I am very much looking forward to talking with Stephen Hill. Stephen Hill is an author, a writer, a guy who I would characterize him as a political scientist, a guy who has studied political reform and government for years, and he's a big proponent of ranked choice voting. And he's going to come on and explain how the problems New York City just experienced have nothing to do with ranked choice voting in the election, meaning they have everything to do with the way that elections are run in the city. I don't want to steal his thunder. Stephen Hill coming up at 1:30. And then at 3:30, David Krell will be here. He's a journalist, an author, a commentator. His latest book is 1962, Baseball and America in the Time of JFK. So I'm looking forward to chatting with him as well. I'm a big Met fan, and you know that 1962 is an ominous year in the history of the Mets, although in some respects it's a very celebratory year. So we'll get into that. 800-848-WABC. Hank is in Daytona Beach. Hello, Hank.
Well, I'm a Bronxite, and I am a Yankees fan, so you have a problem. But just to let you know, the way that things are with the Trumpsters still going around, and I can say that because our governor here in Florida is a Trumpster, and he was so liberal on things. The mayor of Orlando came out today and stated that he is encouraging people to wear masks. We have so many tourists coming down. We have so many children going back to school. My child, when she goes back to school in a few weeks, is going to be required to wear a mask from the family because she's under 12 years old. Those have not been vaccinated and will not be vaccinated. And I don't want to take a chance. You know, it's got to be up to the individual also.
Yeah, not just I get that. But do you think it's wise for the mayor to go forward with this mask mandate in violation of what both the CDC is saying and the guidance from New York State's Department of Health?
Is what the CDC and the State Department of Health say law?
No, it's advisory.
Okay, and it is not in violation.
No. Well, it's
totally
in
against their opinion.
Right. Okay. Right. It is
totally
against the advice and the guidance by those two organizations. I think it's a questionable decision. I guess you think it's not. Why?
Because each individual has to make it up on their own way.
Right, but there'd be nothing that would stop you, as a parent, let's say, from having your child wear the mask.
But if the mayor did not come up and give the people an option, they may not consider it. They may say, well, de Blasio is going along with CDC. The CDC must be right.
Hank, I agree with you in that if a parent or a child or a teacher wants to continue to wear the mask, that should be respected, and we should, and God bless them. That's great. But I think the mayor should then make that clear that you have the option of wearing a mask. That's not what he's doing. He's saying this mask mandate at this point is mandatory. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. We'll talk with Stephen Hill about ranked choice voting and a few other issues coming up in 10 minutes. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
election, friends. That's no small order. Just blow notes, sweep all the votes from Canada to the Mexican border. I started out with a bang, blow the Dixie line. Open and shot was burning hot, and every single vote was mine. From there I swung westward.
Jack Teagarden and his orchestra singing I Swung the Election. We'll talk a little bit about elections and the future of elections with Stephen Hill coming up at 1:30. Very much looking forward to that conversation. Taking your calls about the de Blasio decision to not adhere to the guidance from either the CDC or the New York State Department of Health. I think it's a mistake. I think the mayor should make clear that masks are optional for both teachers and parents, particularly those that have been vaccinated. And I think that what the mayor is doing here is anti-science, and it is a disincentive from getting vaccinated. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. I forgot to mention to Rita Cosby when she was here. I don't know if she's still here, but Rita, if you're still here, come back. But Rita is one of the many employees at our radio station that is owed money in unclaimed funds from the New York State Office of the Office of the New York State Comptroller. So she's owed money from Bergdorf Goodman. So I don't know how much it is, but I meant to tell her about it. I did email her about it or text her about it when I first noticed it a couple of weeks ago. But it turns out all of the on-air personalities here, except for Juliet Huddy and me, are owed money. Everyone else is owed money. Sid Rosenberg, Bernie McGurk, everybody. Brian Kilmeade, even I think Rudy Giuliani is owed money. So if you haven't done this yet, I would strongly suggest that you go to the New York State Comptroller's website and you search the unclaimed funds, type in your name and your town, and you might be surprised to know that you're owed money. A guy that works here, our sales manager, Glenn Tassinelli, I told him he was owed money. I looked him up. He got $110. Said, look, I owe you. Now, that's found money that would have been gone but for him. So you don't know if you – it's worth checking if you're a New Yorker. And I'm sure other states have something similar. But the way New York State administers it, it's better than I've seen in a lot of other states. 800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Vince in Brooklyn. Hello, Vince.
Good morning, Frankie. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Vince.
I'd like to comment on this whole mask fiasco. My girlfriend is a veterinary surgeon, and Frankie, why do you think you need an electron microscope to see any virus at all, whereas most bacteria you could see with a high school microscope? The virus is like an ant compared to the bacteria, which is the Empire State Building. Frankie, if you have any viral particles on any spittle on the outside of your mask, what makes anyone, including that bonehead Fauci, think that the virus cannot work its way through the weave of the mask down your throat? And what makes people think, especially you have tear ducts in your eyes, upper, lower? Why? You think the virus doesn't say, oh, I'm only going to go up your nose, I'm only going to go in your mouth,
exactly,
but I'm not going to go in through your eyes.
Let me ask you this, Vince. Are you the famous Vincent from Brooklyn caused WOR?
Yes, I am.
How is this the first time that you've called me, Vince?
Because
I'm such a fan of yours.
I'm up taking care of business this time of night, and I have you on as I'm taking care of my business. And I said, let me give you a call because I had COVID-19. I was on death's door. And this was not this past February, Frankie, last February, when nobody knew what the hell was going on. I got it. And the only good thing about it was, Frankie, from all the pasta and all the stuff I ate over the holidays, Frankie, I dropped 9 pounds in 5 days because I couldn't even walk to the dinner table to eat. All I was capable of eating was pastina in brodo. So you being Italian, you know what that tastes like. That's baby food.
Well, again, it's not a weight loss plan that I'm recommending to anybody.
No,
but
no.
I'm glad you sound great, Vincent. You sound as good as ever, and I'm glad you're healthy now. So in short, you agree with me. De Blasio is wrong.
Definitely.
This mask mandate.
Frankie, this is all political theater. That's all it is. And you, when you go about your business through the street, you walk by somebody, they pull their mask up, they pull their mask down.
No one's wearing masks on the street anymore.
Well, I see a couple of people here. I recently went into a business and the guy says, you got to put your mask on. I says, yo, I'm vaccinated. I said, if you want me to put a mask on, I'm not coming here and giving you my business.
Well, good for you, Vince. And that's the approach that I generally have tried to take. And thank you for the call, Vince. It's funny, when we were in Atlantic City, my wife would say to me, we're walking on the boardwalk, and a couple of times, and you're talking 2 out of every 1,000 people, they'd be wearing masks outside while walking on the boardwalk. And she'd say to me, why are these people wearing masks outside? These people are outside on the boardwalk in the middle of the sun. But again, I'm not interested in vilifying anybody. I think people should make the right decisions for their own health. Consult with your doctor. Do your research. Make whatever decisions you want to make for you. My problem with what the mayor is doing here in contrivance, is that a word, contrivance? I think it is. In contrivance, if that's a word, with what the CDC is suggesting and the New York State Department of Health is, he's not giving people the option. Now, again, I have every we've seen this movie before, right? The Governor Cuomo press conference a week or so later, where he publicly embarrasses Bill de Blasio and then de Blasio changes his mind. We've seen this movie before. And I have no doubt between now and September, that's exactly what we'll see here. All right. 800-848-9222. We'll talk with Stephen Hill about ranked choice voting in just a minute. If it's a day that ends with Y, more people are bashing ranked choice voting, including the guy that won, Eric Adams. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. I have been an advocate of New York City adopting ranked choice voting since the year 2002. You can listen to and read my testimony to the New York City Charter Revision Commission in 2002, 2003, 2005, 2010, 2017, 2018, and 2019. Back in the early part of that tenure, we would generally refer to this as instant runoff voting. And at the time, most people really didn't understand what it even was. So you have to spend a lot of time talking to people about it. Now, in New York City, my great disappointment with the 2019 Charter Revision Commission was that they didn't have ranked choice voting apply to the general election. They only made it apply to primaries and special elections, which I thought was short-sighted. And since the disaster of the, at least in some respects, of the New York City Democratic primary for mayor, some people are trying to use that experience to do away with ranked choice voting. And I know we have listeners all over the country, but this is also a national movement. There's ranked choice voting in a lot of municipalities around the country. A lot more municipalities are considering moving towards ranked choice voting. And Maine has ranked choice voting for its statewide elections, and a lot of other states are considering it. So before you allow the New York City experience to ruin your perception of ranked choice voting, we're actually going to hear from somebody that knows a thing or two about this, and it's not me. It's Stephen Hill. He's a journalist, a lecturer, and a political professional with decades of experience in politics. He's the author of 7 books, including 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy and Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's winner-take-all politics. And to date, he has written the best op-ed I've read in the New York area about ranked choice voting and what the New York City Board of Elections could have done differently. Mr. Hill, thank you so much for joining me on the radio.
My pleasure, Frank.
So does what we've seen in New York City, does that indicate that ranked choice voting is bad and that other cities shouldn't consider adopting it?
Not at all. You know, when you have a change in the procedures like this, most people tend to focus on how will this impact voters, and you have to do a lot of voter education and outreach in New York City to do that. But it's also a big change for election administrators, and sometimes they mess up with, you know, I mean, running an election is just like a very long to-do list, right? And you have to do those things in a timely fashion, and you suddenly start messing with their to-do list a little bit, and things can go a little bit haywire. So in the case of New York City, they made a rather simple mistake. Before you run an election, they always do testing of the voting equipment. Just makes sense, right? Many states do what's called logic and accuracy tests. I'm not sure what they call it in New York City. But basically what that means is you create a bunch of ballots and you run them through the machine and you count, you see what the machine count is, and then you count those ballots by hand and you compare the hand count to the machine count, make sure everything is squaring the way it's supposed to. Well, in the case of New York City, they did a similar process, but they forgot to delete those results, those results from the test ballots from the central tabulator that you know, accumulates the votes. And so when they ran the RCV tally the first time, they included these test ballots in those first results. Oops, that's not how you're supposed to do it. They quickly discovered the mistake. And then they deleted those ballots, ran the RCV tally again, and everything was, from that point, went straight forward. So, you know, this happens. I mean, in San Francisco, first time they ran the RCV tally, this was in 2004, it didn't work. and it turned out that the vendor, Election Systems and Software, which coincidentally is the same vendor that New York City has, they had made one simple change in their line of code in testing, in which they didn't account for the number of ballots. I mean, when you're doing testing, you're maybe testing a few hundred, few thousand ballots. In San Francisco, they had hundreds of thousands of ballots. And so they didn't allow for that number of ballots to be counted. So they just had to change that line of code. They didn't had to get it recertified by the Secretary of State, because when you make a change like that, it has, you know, you have to have election administrators looking over it, make sure it's done correctly. Then it was recertified. They ran the tally, and everything went forwards without a hitch after that. So these things happen.
This error, this testing error, which caused a lot of confusion early on here in New York, it's not unprecedented, and other municipalities have dealt with similar errors, and they've moved past them.
Exactly, and incidentally, there are elections, non-ranked choice voting elections, that also have similar problems sometimes, where, you know, the election equipment or the preparations, the procedures, somehow they mess them up, and you have a problem. But, you know, by and large, they do have ways to do a reconciliation afterwards. Like I said, a lot of states have what's called a 1% manual tally after the election, where they have to they hand count a certain number of ballots and they compare that to the machine counts and they have to square. So there are built-in checks to this kind of thing to catch these sorts of errors that happen, and these sorts of errors happen in every election. Voters just don't hear about it because they correct them and then they move on.
And I will note that the turnout in this New York City Democratic primary for mayor was the largest that it's been in any Democratic primary for mayor, or Republican primary for that matter, in 30 years, more than 30 years. And it was not as if voters were paralyzed with confusion and there were no long lines at the poll sites because voters couldn't figure out how to count to five. The voters seem to understand at least how to vote and bubble in one through five. So, exactly.
I mean, you know, it's kind of when you compare to, like, you go to Baskin Robbins, 31 flavors of ice cream, and you say, "What's your favorite flavor of ice cream?" Well, it's Rocky Road. Well, we don't have that one. What's your second favorite?
Right.
Oh, it's Cherry Garcia. What's your third?
you know, people are used to ranking things all the time. Right. You see ranking on your, you know, your favorite celebrities, your favorite movie stars in movies. Americans love to rank.
Right.
So idea that somehow we can't rank our favorite candidates, for, it just never has made sense to me. And I think, you know, all the places that are using it now, it just shows that it does work. Voters do like it. There was a poll done after the New York City election. They found that 95% of voters said ranked choice voting is simple. So, you know, there you have it.
All right. We're talking with Stephen Hill. He's a journalist, lecturer, and political professional with a lot of experience, author of 7 books, including 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy and Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics. If you have a question about ranked choice voting, you can call in and we'll do our best to answer it, or Stephen will do our best to answer it. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Stephen, let me ask you about these comments made by the winner of the Democratic primary, Eric Adams, on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday. This is what he said.
We need to move deeper into the 21st century. We need to utilize technology. Would you believe when they did ranked choice voting, they introduced it in January. They were not ready. The pandemic hit. And then right now, the only person that's in the room when they push the button to determine the ranking is one person. That is not transparency. That is not how we should move towards reform in this area. So I say yes, I'm hoping the state come together and put in place some real reform that would professionalize the operation and then pay the employees better, give them the equipment they need. Let's move this important process forward.
What did you make of Eric Adams' comments there, Stephen Hill?
Well, I think the point that he's making, which is valid, is that the Board of Elections in New York City has had many problems for quite a few years. It's known as being rife with people put there for patronage reasons, not for their expertise in running elections. But I have to say, you know, across the country in the United States, if your average election administrator, for example, it's not like you go to school somewhere to learn how to administer election. And, you know, maybe 20 years ago when you were running election and it was all paper ballots and you were counting things by hand and, you know, it didn't require someone to know something about technology. But today, elections are done on computers. The databases for voter databases are fairly complex. It's a huge running election in a place like New York City. It's an enormous undertaking. And so doesn't it make sense that we would have a place where election administrators are trained and highly technical individuals? I think it does. But, there's more attention and focus on oversight of slot machines and casinos.
That's true.
Than there is of our elections in the United States. And so, you know, it's like every election, I'm surprised we don't hear about more crazy stuff happening than we already hear about, because there's just so little control over how this used. I mean, for example, there's 3 big election equipment vendors in the United States: ES&S, Election Systems and Software, Dominion, and Hart InterCivic. And ES&S is by far the biggest. I think they have like 60% of the market. And so, you know, they basically go around to all these different counties and cities, and they shop their equipment. And there's really not a whole lot of oversight to this process. And, you know, there's a lot of a revolving door between the industry and the administration, election administrators, all the sorts of things that we have learned shouldn't be in an important, crucial infrastructure like elections. And yet that is the state of the art. Most countries have a national elections commission that creates standards, you know, at least the minimum standards that everybody has to live by. And here in the U.S., we have strong traditions of decentralization, all these sorts of things. But it's not like you have to have a commission that tells everybody what to do. It's more partnering with state and local governments to run good elections. That's what it's about. And we don't have that here in the United States.
One of the things that I think did frustrate people about this New York City experience is that it took 3 weeks to find out who the winner was. Now, I was talking with someone on the way in today. I was previewing my interview with you, and I was on the phone with them. And they said basically, well, what do other jurisdictions that use ranked choice voting do? Are they able to get the results right away? Because, you know, New Yorkers and Americans in general, they want accurate results, but they also want to know pretty soon, right after the polls close, basically, who won and who lost. How does it work in cities like San Francisco and Oakland and in other places where they use ranked choice voting? Are they able to tell people the results right away? And how come we can't do that in New York?
Absolutely. I mean, in San Francisco, you know, we have more absentee ballots percentage of the electorate in San Francisco than you have in New York City. In New York City, the last figure I saw is going to be about 15 to 20% of ballots will be absentee ballots. In San Francisco, it's regularly 40%. Okay, so even despite that, on election night, they run the RCV tally with the ballots that they have. And then on each subsequent day, they run the RCV tally and give election results for that days of the ballots that they have now processed by 5 p.m. And that's an important thing to do, because otherwise you create false expectations about what's really going on in that election. So in the New York City election, you had Eric Adams that was ahead by like 9 or 10 points with first choice, first rankings only. And so it looks like Eric Adams is way out in front. But in fact, because his two leading opponents had more support, more broad-based support among the second and third place rankings, that election was closer than people realize. And if they had run the RCV tally on election night, everyone would have immediately known, wow, this is a really close election.
So 4 years
from now, you actually could have problems. So in the Oakland 2010 mayor election, we had a similar situation like you had in New York City. You had a front runner who was way out in front by about 10 points, and everybody built up this expectation, oh, he's going to win easily. And when they ran the RCV tally about 4 days later for the first time, because initially they didn't do it on election night there either, suddenly they found that the candidate who was in second place initially was actually now in first place. They were now the front runner. And so you had 4 days of people building up this expectation, a false expectation, it turned out, that candidate A was going to win, and instead candidate B did.
So,
and this caused a lot of people to be upset. They didn't understand. So, it undermined the acceptance of the system in actual fact. And imagine if Garcia had passed Eric Adams.
Right. Well, it could have happened. It could have happened. So I guess just to come back to my question, and we're talking with Stephen Hill. He's author of the book 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. Just to come back to my question, is it possible to get results right away in a ranked choice voting election? Or do you have to wait 3 or 4 days, as that Oakland example from 2010 indicates?
No, you can get it right away. And so when you run that first tally on election night, if the election isn't close, right, you'll know right away at that point, this is a candidate who's going to win. If it's a close election and there's a lot of absentee ballots out there, then you know, oh, we won't know until we process more absentee ballots. And this, that's why it's important to run that tally every day after that, so you can see how that election is progressing. So, and that's the same in a non-RCV election. Many times we know already on election night, based on the number of ballots and the difference between the candidates, who's going to win, even if there's a lot of outstanding absentee ballots, because the front runner is just too far
ahead.
So
the problem with what New York did was they didn't run that RCV tally on election night?
Exactly.
I see.
Exactly.
By
not doing that, they really created a lot of problems in the understanding of what was going on in election. In fact, I would say until you run that RCV tally, you really don't know what's going on in that election, and you are giving out false information potentially, because, as I said, it looks like Eric Adams was ahead by 10 points, and it was actually an extremely close race. And if they had hit that button for that RCV tally, they would have known that.
All right.
On election night.
Now, we have a lot of people that are traditionalists in our audience. We have a lot of people that are self-proclaimed old-timers. What is wrong with the style of elections that so many of us grew up with, as simple as whoever gets the most votes wins? Why is that a bad system?
Well, the reason why it's a bad system is because you can end up with an election result that doesn't accurately represent what voters really wanted. Because you can have an election where, you have, say, three candidates running, and two of those candidates are conservative candidates in a conservative district. So normally a conservative would win that district. And yet the conservative vote splits and allows the liberal candidate to win with 40% of the vote. Mm. So the conservative vote was 60%, but it split among two candidates, and say those two conservative candidates ended up with 35% and 25%. And then you have a liberal candidate with 40% who wins a conservative district or a conservative city. So, what ranked choice voting is about is ensuring that the actual the candidate who wins really represents a majority of the voters in that jurisdiction that's holding the election. That's what's fair. And, it really makes the most sense now that we have the technology to do it. And more, we're a very diverse society. There's all sorts of people out there from different points of view. You want to have candidates that represent the majority of what people believe.
So I think everyone acknowledges, at least anybody that's intellectually honest, that from a voter's perspective, it's pretty simple just to rank votes. I don't think anybody is still saying that that aspect of things is too complicated for voters. What I do think, what I am hearing more and more, is that the counting process and the tallying process is a bit complicated for voters. I'm wondering if you can speak to that issue. Is this just too difficult for voters to follow in terms of the counting and the tabulation of the ranked choice voting?
I don't think so. The way that voters should think about it, like in New York City, you already have runoff elections, right? This is just like doing a runoff, and that's why we used to call it instant runoff. It's just like doing a runoff, but you're asking voters, look, so that we don't have to bring you back for a second election, tell us who your runoff choice would be right now on the same ballot. That's all right. They're doing. They're indicating, here's my favorite candidate, and here's my runoff choice in case my first candidate can't win.
All right.
And by doing that, it really liberates the voter to vote for the candidates they really like, because how many times do voters go through this mental process? Well, I like, this candidate over here, but I know she doesn't stand a chance of winning, and I'm going to throw my vote away by giving it to her. And instead, the candidate who I like even less might squeak in. So I guess I'm going to hold my nose and vote for the lesser of two evils, right? With ranked choice voting now, you can put that candidate, your favorite candidate, first, knowing that if she can't win or he can't win, your vote now is going to go to your backup choice, your runoff choice. All right. That's the great advantage of this system.
I want to squeeze in a couple of calls for Stephen Hill, a ranked choice voting expert and proponent. 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Shirley is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hello, Shirley.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to know, because I guess I was going to ask the question, what is the purpose of the ranked choice voting? And I guess your guess was someone answering that. So my second question is, are the votes from, like, say, candidate number five, who's in the fifth position, once they get knocked off, are their votes then added on to the next person in front of them?
Well, the way to think of it is, it's not the candidate's vote, it's your vote. So if your first choice doesn't win, your vote goes to your second choice. And if your second choice can't use that vote to win, it's going to go to your third choice and fourth choice and your fifth choice. So it just keeps going to your choices as long as your previous candidate can't use that vote to win. And what that means is that your lower choices can't help defeat your higher choices. So you don't have to worry about, should I not rank this candidate because it's going to help maybe defeat another candidate who I like even more, because your vote doesn't go to your second or third or fourth or fifth choice until the higher candidates have already been eliminated. So it's really to your advantage to use all of your rankings if you have five choices. I mean, other places like San Francisco, voters have 10 choices.
Yeah, well, and that was my urging to the Charter Revision Commission that in 2018. They got conflicting advice, one from Susan Lerner of Common Cause, who said only allow ranking up to five. My suggestion was that San Francisco model of allowing up to 10, and they chose to listen to Susan Lerner instead of me. It's not the first time nor the last that I was ignored. Let me ask you this, Stephen, before we run out of time. You wrote this book, which I haven't read yet, but I have ordered, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy and Fixing Elections. In addition to ranked choice voting, give folks one or two other steps that we can take to improve the nature of our elections.
Sure. So, you know, I referred to some of them: better training for election administrators, better voting equipment, you know, voting equipment that's designed to help voters to successfully vote and not accidentally pick two candidates in the, you know, for the same choice, and that invalidates your ballot. I also am a supporter of public financing of campaigns. I, you know, to me, it's a matter of voter information. You want voters, when they go into that voter's booth or they're voting from home, to have the best information they can to make a good choice. And if you have candidates, that, only the candidates that have access to a lot of money, personal, private money, whether their own or, you know, wealthy donors, if they're the only ones that can speak, so to speak, to the voters, then it distorts the public discussion and doesn't mean – it means voters don't have access to all the information they need to make a good choice.
We're going to have to have you on in the future to talk about that and some other ideas, because the way that we've done matching funds and public financing in New York City, it's been a total disaster. But I think other cities like Seattle that have implemented democracy vouchers, that's definitely a step in the right direction. Stephen Hill, thank you for the time this morning. I hope we could chat again soon. If you want to chat with me, if you want to comment on my discussion with Stephen Hill, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Next hour, we'll talk a little bit about a lot of different things, including a school that may have too many white people. I'll tell you about it next. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Until then, help control the pet population. Get your dog or cat spayed or neutered.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Problems with society is too many white people. I mean, these whites are out of control. They're everywhere. And finally, there is now a public school principal that is doing something about all these whites that are running around like crazy. The faculty of a Washington Heights high school is rebelling against their principal, charging in a vote of no confidence that she has flagrantly, but unsuccessfully, attempted to divide our school by race. But quick aside here. I don't know about you, but when did everything in this country become a racial issue? 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I would go through my whole day and nobody would mention anything about race. I was I didn't feel being that I was the victim of racism. I would generally keep my own racism in check as I was discriminating against people from other races. Now, every issue, political issues, sports issues, business issues, educational issues, every issue is a racial issue. But anyway, the story here is an interesting one. Paula Lev, principal of the High School for Law and Public Service, is now under investigation by the city's Department of Education for allegedly telling a faculty member she, quote, was going to get rid of all these white teachers that aren't doing anything for the kids of our community. It's according to a DOE complaint. Paula Lev, a Dominican, also asked the faculty member to conspire with her to try to oust a white colleague, according to the complaint filed last week with the DOE's Office of Equal Opportunity. According to the New York Post, I'm going to link to this article, by the way, if you haven't read it. You can go to my Facebook page, facebook.com/MoranoFan. That's facebook.com/MoranoFan. But according to the New York Post, the complaint says she definitely has something against white people. On the last day of school, Ms. Lev gave the faculty member a notice that he was placed in excess, meaning no longer needed at the school. Basically, you're fired. You're fired with a paycheck. You're no longer at that school, but you still got to collect a check, and should look for a job elsewhere in the DOE. He blew the whistle on her, and a week later, he was excessed. The complaint came amidst simmering unrest at the school, which staffers blamed on what they said was Lev twisting the current concepts of equity and anti-racism, which the DOE promotes and teachers overwhelmingly support. Dissatisfaction with Lev, 39, only 39 years old, already principal of a school. I mean, that's, she got promoted pretty quickly and at a pretty young age. But dissatisfaction with Ms. Lev boiled up in February when teacher Nick Bacon, the union chapter leader, filed a routine grievance about a scheduling issue that could have affected most of the faculty. In front of a half dozen other staffers, Lev questioned Bacon's motives. "I wasn't sure what your problem with me was. Maybe it's because I'm a woman of color and you're a white man," the principal asked Bacon, according to a March 2nd letter to the superintendent and signed by most of the school's tenured members. Staffers were outraged that Lev had seemingly accused Bacon, who was raising their labor concerns, of being racist. The school has a diverse staff, about half white, some Jewish and Greek. A mix of black, Hispanic, and Asian make up the rest. So the grievance raised by Bacon was resolved in the union's favor. And in an effort, to quell the furor over Lev's remark, Ramirez agreed, that's the superintendent, in a meeting that what she said was inappropriate, but added that the comment expressed Lev's feelings and urged Bacon to work with her. In a later meeting with Bacon, Lev apologized for making the remark openly at a staff conference, but not for the substance of her comments, saying it reflected her true feelings and should have been expressed to him alone. Now, understand that. That's nuts. That a principal gets caught playing the race card with not only a teacher that works for her, but the teacher who's the union chapter leader, and when she's exposed for her hostility towards white people and playing the race card, her reaction is saying, "Oh, I shouldn't have said it publicly, but that is how I feel, so I should have just expressed it to you privately." Now, that's pretty dangerous that she would say this in an on-the-record setting. It's pretty dangerous that this woman has influence over educating New York City school children. That's crazy. In my view, this woman should be fired immediately. Or at least reassigned so that she's not a principal. 800-848-WABC if you want to disagree. That's 1-800-848-9222. So at the same time, people that were at this meeting said Lev, again, that's the principal, suggested that Bacon, that's the union chapter leader, read the 2018 book by Robin DiAngelo, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, which argues essentially that whites get defensive when questioned about racial inequality. She said that Bacon could join her and other staffers in studying the book and have courageous conversations. That's an actual term, courageous conversations, coined by a consultant hired by the DOE to give implicit bias workshops for its employees. And that's really what I think the crux of the issue is here. Look, when you have thousands of employees, you're going to have, whether we're talking teachers, principals, cops, sanitation, firefighters, radio talk show hosts, DOT people, bus drivers, whatever. When you have thousands of anything, you're going to have people that are rotten. It's just the nature of the beast. It's just the numbers. You can have a couple of people that are bad, whether they're racist or whether they're lazy or whether they're criminal, whatever. But the fact that she used this term, courageous conversations, which is a term promoted by a DOE consultant in these implicit bias workshops for employees, tells me that some of the, I'll call them anti-white principals and or superintendents that are in the DOE system feel emboldened in their anti-whiteness by these consultants. Now, maybe you think that's a bridge too far, but I think it's pretty, this is pretty damning evidence that that's the case. So 4 months after the conflict involving Mr. Bacon, another faculty member filed the discrimination complaint, alleging that Lev had pressured him to help her engineer the ouster of a colleague, an unidentified white female staffer. Lev wanted the faculty member to get a state education certification so he would not have the same title as the targeted colleague, clearing the way for Lev to access the more senior staffer. Should you understand what they're alleging here? There are two people essentially doing the same job. One's a person of color. One is white. Lev, the principal, says to the person of color, psst, get a state certification. This way, you won't have the same title as that white lady. And we can access her and keep you. Now, if that's true, that's outrageous. And if this is not behavior that is dealt with swiftly by the DOE and harshly, I think it tells you everything you need to know about the kind of people that are running our school system. 800-848-WABC. This is what the complaint says. Ms. Lev has asked me to conspire with her on a couple of occasions in getting rid of my colleague. She also stated to me in Spanish that she was going to get rid of all these white teachers that aren't doing anything for the kids of our community. The complaint concludes, I believe Ms. Lev is not suited for the position of principal, gee, you think, because of the comments she has made to me about white people and the malicious ways in which she thinks and speaks. She's not fit to be a leader of a school. As a school staff, we have lost confidence, credibility, trust, and most importantly, we have lost hope in Ms. Lev as a principal at the High School for Law and Public Service. So according to the New York Post, frustrated staffers said that Bacon reached out to Chancellor Maisha Porter in early July, begging her to intervene after Ramirez failed to resolve the conflict. So on June 24th, most of the school's nearly 50 faculty members met to consider four possible reasons to vote no confidence in this principal, including that she, number one, flagrantly but unsuccessfully attempted to divide our school community based on race. Number two, disrespected, slandered, and or arbitrarily gone after respected educators to the detriment of our entire school community. The ballot also gave as reasons that Lev constantly violated our contract and failed to collaborate with the staff on important school decisions. With almost the entire 40-plus membership of the school voting, including both tenured and untenured teachers, paraprofessionals, and related service professionals, 83.3% voted that they no longer have confidence in our principal to lead our school. That's according to an email to staffers. Now, I have been following – I went to New York City Public School my whole life until I was in college. And I have a lot of friends that are teachers currently. I have had friends that are a lot of teachers for many years. I've dated several women that were teachers in the New York City public school system. I have never seen, and I'm sure it's happened before, but I have never seen, and I've been following this stuff for a long time, a vote of no confidence in a principal by the faculty. I have never seen it in a New York City public school. Apparently, according to the Post, the faculty, which I was unaware of, the faculty of Forest Hills High School in Queens voted no confidence in a principal a couple of years ago, and they removed that principal, Ben Sherman, from the school, but they gave him a bureaucratic post at the same salary. Now, this woman, Ms. Lev, was named interim acting principal of this school in February of 2020, right before the COVID shutdown. She was awarded the post late last year after filling in for the founding principal who retired. Previously, before she was the acting principal, she served 3 years as an instructional specialist for the DOE's special ed data system. Before that, she was a special ed assistant principal for 3 years and a special ed teacher for 3 years. This woman, her salary was $165,542 last year. She's married to another principal, Benjamin Lev. I'd be curious what's going on in Benjamin Lev's school. Now, she did not return any calls from the New York Post seeking comment, and a spokesperson for the DOE would not comment on the faculty's vote of no confidence. I think this is outrageous. I think this principal needs to go. And I think this is a principal who felt emboldened to push her white-hating views because of the approach at the Department of Education, including these consultants that do these implicit bias workshops where they feature the discussions about courageous conversations. Now, could it be that it's just one bad apple? Sure, absolutely. However, I suspect there's something more broad, more insidious going on here. Love to hear your thoughts. 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Coming up in the 3 o'clock hour, we're going to talk with David Krell about the 1960s as it relates to both baseball and politics. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Let me say hello to Ted in Forest Hills. Hello, Ted.
Yes, thank you. You know, my sister taught Caucasian is in a all Afro-American school, but this was a couple of years ago. I think things have changed. Maybe there's like a sisterhood or brotherhood of people who think the same thing is to get the white person out rather than having the best person do the job. And that's my concern. And that can bring the whole system down, or any system where the best isn't the leader. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ted. I think that's a valid concern. And I think the fact that she used the same language from the DOE consultant playbook is an indication that this goes beyond just one school or one principal. And I don't think that you would have seen this 15 years ago under Joel Klein or Dennis Walcott or Harold Levy or any of a number of previous commissioners or chancellors of schools. And I think this is the byproduct of this anti-white ideology that has made its way into the consulting playbook over at the New York City Department of Education. I'm sorry. 800-848-9222. You're welcome to disagree. And again, this could just be one bad principal. Could be one principal who happens to be racist, and she's trying to get other teachers to go along with the consequences of her racism. Could be. Could be. I'm not discounting that. And if you have any inside information, you can – we'll preserve your anonymity if you give us a call, 1-800-848-WABC. It's 1-800-848-9222. I do want to remind you, if you have not – if you're a New Yorker and you have not checked the office of the New York State Comptroller for unclaimed funds, you are potentially shortchanging yourself, because I am amazed at how often I type in people's names that I know personally – and unclaimed funds come up. Bernie McGurk has unclaimed funds. Sid Rosenberg, Curtis Sliwa, Rudy Giuliani, everybody. Almost everybody. Juliet doesn't, and I don't. Everybody else does. 800-848-9222 if you want to comment on this or anything else. This is The Other Side of Midnight. We'll continue right after this.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC. On the island, baby.
One of my favorite communities in the world. And on Wednesday, the first lady of our radio station, Margot Katsimatidis, will be throwing out the first pitch at the Brooklyn Cyclones game. Those of you that listen to the Cats Roundtable Sunday mornings might have heard John and me talking about it, but it's pretty neat. I think we're going to be carrying the, at least the, I don't know if we're carrying the whole game, but we're carrying the audio simulcast of that first pitch. And I love that neighborhood, and I worked there at that very ballpark for 3 years, and I'm a big Brooklyn Cyclones fan. It's probably one of my favorite professional sports teams in the world. So it's a great honor that Margot is being able to throw out the first pitch. And she and her husband, John owns our radio station. They've done a lot for Coney Island, and I have a feeling they're going to continue to do a lot for minor league baseball and independent league baseball. I got a preview of some things that might be happening on that front. And I think there's going to be some very interesting news on that front. So we'll see what happens. Now, I did see – my wife and I did watch a film yesterday. It's called Hot Rod. Now, I have a lengthy Netflix queue. It's about 500 DVDs deep. But we only have a DVD player on it with our television set upstairs, and we have to kind of hook it up. So it's a little bit of a production. It doesn't have the ease of watching it digitally. So sometimes – my wife will want to watch a film but not go to the trouble of hooking up the DVD player and everything. So I also noticed recently that she has not liked a lot of the selections that are on my Netflix list, which is the things that you can watch digitally that you don't need a DVD for. So recently I've been trying to add more film selections that I think she's going to like. And she's a big fan of comedy. I am too. And so I looked up the 50 best comedies that are available on Netflix right now. And this was one. And I have to tell you, and it said in the description that it was stupid. And I'm not against stupid films or slapstick. I love Naked Gun. I love Hot Shots, Spy Hard. Yeah, I love Monty Python. I love all those. But this film, I got to tell you, it stars Andy Samberg and Isla Fisher. Bill Hader is in it as well. Danny McBride. And not a bad cast overall. It is so incredibly dumb. It's also not funny. And I asked my wife what she thought of it after we watched it. And she said that she basically thought it was a waste of time, even though she laughed a couple of times. I didn't really. I think I laughed once. And if you're going to be a comedy and you're not going to be producing any laughter, what's the point? So the film was called Hot Rod. It's 14 years old by now. So chances are if you were going to see it, you probably would have seen it. But I found it to be incredibly disappointing. So for any of you that are relying on that same list, the 50 best comedies that are available on Netflix right now, I would suggest you skip right over Hot Rod. The best thing that you can say about it, now, again, there are, it has its moments, and there were a couple of interesting pieces of audio that I might even take and play on the show at different moments. But the best thing you can say about it is it's short. It's only 80 minutes, which when you don't have a lot of time, you know, there's a lot to be said for brevity. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Charles is in Queens. Hello, Charles. Charles? Moving on, Charles, moving on. 800. Well, didn't he do that with Rita's show today, too? Didn't he call in and then was not available? That's it. Charles, you've lost your phone privileges. Let me say hello to, is this Deanne in Westchester?
Yes, it is.
Hello, Deanne.
Oh, well, it's so nice to talk to you. And I'm calling. Usually I'm not up this late, but I was on a plane flight from Charlotte to White Plains. And we were delayed on the tarmac for about an hour.
Oh, no.
And I only got home about half an hour ago. So
I'm sorry for your inconvenience, but I'm glad that you were getting you as a listener.
Well, the good news was that I'm 80, and I was seated next to a gentleman who was 90. And both of us started a conversation. And because we were delayed on the tarmac, we had plenty of time to talk. And he was a bit hard, more than a bit hard of hearing, but we were able to communicate very well. And we started talking about how the world is going in our eyes, our senior eyes. And we were talking about the school system and how our children and our grandchildren are being taught things that we don't necessarily agree with. And we're very upset with all of this safe space stuff and the pronouns and all of the things that, hey, just get a spine and live with it, because you've got to face the real world. But all of a sudden, everybody takes offense. Meanwhile, there was a person sitting immediately behind us. And all at once, in a tortured voice, she said, "Oh, you're disturbing me. You're hurting me. What you're saying is I'm a professor. I'm a professor in college." And this was a lady who, well, looked a lot like our present vice president. And she's a professor in probably a Westchester college. I don't know. Anyway, she said, "You must stop. I really can't stand the way you're talking." And, you know, we were here in an enclosed space in an airplane. What was going in my head was, number one, you're eavesdropping. And number two, you're not respecting the fact that we're seniors and this man is deaf and I need to speak to him. It was a really interesting episode. And he and I got the drift very well and we kept our voices down. But I was appalled. And I want to know what you think.
Well, look, obviously it's difficult for me to judge not being there. I totally empathize with with your position and his, in that you're first of all, you're annoyed that you're delayed for an hour and you're trying to make the wait kind of bearable by talking to the person next to you. And I think educational policy and what's acceptable on campus is certainly an acceptable level of conversation. I don't know how loud the two of you were being in order for you to disturb the person behind you. It sounds like she was a little bit rude in the way that she asked you to keep your voice down. But it sounds like the two of you exercised common courtesy as best you could by lowering your voice. Now, when you said she looked like Kamala Harris, other than the fact that I guess she was black, what exactly were the similarities that she had with Kamala Harris?
Well, I would say she was mixed race.
Mixed race. Okay. All right. That kind of came out of nowhere, the she looked like Kamala Harris. I was waiting for a reference to Kamala Harris to come in. I mean, why? It's kind of an odd thing. All right, 800-848-WABC. Steve is in Manhattan. Steve, hello.
I thought that story was going to end like as a love story or something.
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah, it was a little anticlimactic. That's the thing. I was expecting either a love story or fisticuffs or somebody being arrested, but it just sort of lingered there, you know?
Right. I was expecting to get hit over the head with a Valentine's card, but it didn't end that way.
Yeah, I enjoyed your call to Rita in the 12 o'clock hour. Who were you on that show today? Were you Doug?
Frank, there's like 100 Steve from Manhattan imitators calling talk radio.
There are, yes.
Credit for all these great
we got guys. The original. Listen, we got the original.
Right. You have the original, and you will always have the original. The thing is, people have to realize now, whether it's the school system or public schools or colleges or anything, private colleges, there are millions of people inside this country who hate this country now. I know there's a lot of smart people out there, but I've seen through the years that on an emotional level, they cannot deal with that. They cannot deal with the fact that there are millions of people amongst us who hate this country, want to see it destroyed, and want to forget about what they want to turn it into. They're not going to turn it into anything but into a garbage dump. That's what they're going to turn it into. But the thing is, I like to emphasize, Frank, is that I know you're going to get mad when I say this, but people should realize when people are down on their luck and they're down, Harpo Marx was living in his mother's basement in Brooklyn taking college courses. How the mighty have fallen.
Yeah, I'm not sure why you think I would get mad about that. I'm a big fan of the Marx brothers, Harpo included. And again, I'm not necessarily sure how it relates to this story of this principal, Miss Lev. I think you're a little bit off topic tonight, Steve. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Neil on Staten Island. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Frank. You don't have a game system, do you? Like an Xbox or?
I don't. No.
Because you could play DVDs on those.
Yeah. No, I mean, wouldn't I have to still hook that up to the television set the same way that I would a DVD player?
Yeah, we usually I don't know anybody that hooks them up and disconnects them. Usually they keep them on there permanently. And
Recently I did order an HDMI splitter, which I think will allow me to have both our Fire Stick and the DVD hooked up at the same time. But that's a project for tomorrow.
All right, just a thought. What I wanted to do about the Mets, I had a friend that went to the Mets game on Saturday, and they didn't treat the guy right. I mean, the prices are crazy. I mean, you know, he bought a French fry and a soda. Guess how much a French fry and a soda was?
I'm going to say $24.
Oh, no. Well, $16.
Oh, $16.
Which I think it's outrageous.
Well, you know what, though, Neil, I agree. And that's one of the reasons I don't like going to Major League Baseball games anymore. I much prefer Minor League Baseball games. But my question is, though, for your friend, at this point, everybody knows the prices are crazy when you go to a Major League Baseball game. So how could he have been surprised? It's not as if he was expecting to pay $5 for French fries and a soda. I mean, he had to know that the prices have gone crazy.
Well, what I was going to say was that was only really a prelude.
Ah.
His daughter has multiple sclerosis. It's very hard for her to walk.
Ah.
So she couldn't walk up the stairs. So they found somebody that worked there, and they said, go to this office, and they'll get you a handicap seat. So he went to the office with her, and they got a handicap seat, but they charged him $10 more for each ticket for a handicap
seat.
Well,
that's not right. I don't approve of that.
I think that was against the ADA. I thought that was really in bad taste to do something like that.
Agreed.
So that's the only thing reason I bring that up.
Was he at game one or game two of Saturday's doubleheader?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hopefully for his sake, he was at game two and at least got to see your Mets victory. But, yeah, I agree with you. That's I was telling my wife yesterday, she was saying, do you want to make plans to go to a Met game this season? I said, you know, I never thought I'd be this guy. But I am now, and we'll talk more about baseball next hour and its place in the American zeitgeist, but I have become more of the opinion that I actually prefer watching the games on television than to going to the games in person, the major league games. I still enjoy going to the minor league games. But the major league games, almost like a lot of you when we were doing the segment on going to the movies, it's such a production. First of all, you have to travel out to Queens or the Bronx. There's always traffic. You have to either take two trains and a ferry, or a bus and a train, or you have to drive and then pay to park, then pay the – first of all, you've already paid the crazy price for the ticket, then pay the crazy price for the concessions. I actually have come to prefer and a lot of times it's easier to follow what's going on while you're watching the game on TV. It's a much better, depending on where you're sitting, much better way of watching the pitcher, watching the batter, seeing the nuances of the batter's stance and everything else. So I don't know. Maybe it's part of getting old. Is that
I just found it entertaining. You love baseball, though,
I
Frank.
Do.
That's
I
the
do.
Crazy thing.
Yeah. So, again, I still like the going to the minor league games. And I will go to a couple of games probably this year. But I find it too much – I find it to be much less of a priority for me than it used to be, going to the major league games. What was your experience like at that Saturday game? Did they try to charge you more for a handicap ticket or anything?
No. I went to
you went Friday.
Friday night. But, I mean, I got $10 tickets off of SeatGeek. We probably paid more to park the car than we did for the actual tickets, and to Neil's point, the drinks and food prices are crazy, but it's kind of part of the experience.
Right, that's what I'm saying. You kind of have to know that going in. That's baked in.
But I enjoy. See, baseball, I do not care about baseball much. I don't enjoy watching it on TV at all. I think it's too slow, and I really kind of lose interest pretty quickly in it. But I love going to baseball games, especially Met games.
Well, why especially Met games?
I like Citi Field. I think there's a really nice ambiance to it.
That's
true. You go to Yankee Stadium, it's really sterile and very corporate and boring.
You're 100% right about that. But you should try and go Wednesday night to the Cyclones game that Margo is thrown out the first pitch to. That's a real intimate experience.
I went 2 weeks ago, actually, to a Cyclones game.
Oh, you did? Who did they play?
I forget who it was. It was the Phillies affiliate. The Jersey Shore team. I cannot remember the name of
them. The Aberdeen Ironbirds?
No, Jersey Shore. The team that used to be Lakewood.
See, they did the restructuring of minor league baseball, so I don't know who's
– I can't
not the Lakewood Blue Claws.
Whatever they're called now.
I see.
Yeah, but so my buddy – excuse me. My buddy actually works for the New York Post, and he was working on a story about three of the Mets prospects that ran in the paper early this week. And he was there, so we bought a couple tickets and sat down on third baseline. It was a lot of fun.
Well, no, it definitely is.
It's a great park.
And I'll point out that the winner of last night's home run derby, Pete Alonso, is a former Brooklyn Cyclone himself. So it's very interesting to see two-time home run derby winner Pete Alonso being victorious again. But also the fact that the Brooklyn Cyclones alumni are continuing to move on to bigger and better things. Here's the thing I don't understand, and I asked Christian about this off-air yesterday, and maybe this is me being out of touch, but when I used to watch the home run, Pete Alonso is not on the All-Star team. He didn't make the team. He should have. I love Pete Alonso. He's a great player. He's one of my favorites. But he's still in the home run derby. I don't understand. Well, years ago, only the players that were in the All-Star game were allowed to participate in the home run derby. I don't know how they let you – I don't know what the criteria is now. Do they let any Buddy participate in the Home Run Derby? I don't think that's the case. So why did Pete – and I'm thrilled that Pete Alonso got to participate, because at least we're going to see a Met this week, because there are no Mets that are going to be playing in the game tonight unless Taijuan Walker gets an inning or two. But you had DeGrom, who made the team. He's not going to pitch because of the schedule. And the fun thing about the All-Star game – and I get, and Sid Rosenberg keeps making this point on the WABC Early News, but the fun thing about the All-Star game is you used to see these great matchups, and Sid keeps saying how with interleague play that's a lot less significant, and that's true. But with the All-Star game, the reason every team gets a representative is so that every fan has a player, at least one player to root for. And that's really not the case if you're a Met fan this year. So it was nice to see Pete Alonso win that Home Run Derby. But I just don't understand when they changed that you can participate in the Home Run Derby without actually being on the All-Star team. But whatever. Different strokes for different folks. 800-848-9222. Hey, the other story that I thought was interesting, and I just texted him in the hopes that we could get him on this morning. But do you see who's running for governor of California? The radio talk show host, Larry Elder. Now, I don't think Larry was ever carried regularly on WABC. He was on KABC for many years. And from what I remember, when we were carrying Laura Ingraham at night, whenever she was off, they'd occasionally carry Larry Elder's show instead. I don't think he might have been carried for a short time regularly, maybe like 4 or 5 months, but nothing longer than that. But he's probably somebody that you've seen on television or heard on other radio stations. He's a great radio talk show host, and he's a heck of a nice guy, I have to say. So it'll be interesting to see. Now, I don't believe that California uses ranked choice voting. So up until now, I mean, for their statewide elections, for their statewide recall elections, up until now, the highest profile Republican candidate has been Caitlyn Jenner. But now that you have two center-right candidates, prominent center-right candidates in that race, it may make it impossible for the Republicans to win. Because had you had ranked choice voting, people would feel free to rank Elder first and Jenner second, or vice versa. Now there's a very real danger that Elder could split the vote from Jenner or vice versa. But who knows? If that happens, maybe that'll be the proof that California needs to adopt ranked choice voting. But I've met Larry Elder many times. I wouldn't call him a friend, but we're certainly friendly. I just texted him in the hopes maybe he'll come on tomorrow to talk about why he decided to finally take the plunge. He's one of those guys that's been rumored to be a political candidate for many years, and finally now he's taken the plunge. Hey, I want to urge you, if you're on Facebook, join the Facebook fan group. Just go on Facebook to Marano Radio, Fans and Haters. Just search that. It's a private group, but we'll be happy to have you if you listen to the show. Marano Radio, Fans and Haters. And you can also join our standard Facebook page, facebook.com/MaranoFan. We're trying to build a social media empire here. One Facebook like at a time, one Twitter follower at a time. You can follow me on Twitter at Frank Morano. That's Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O. 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to E. Frank in Astoria. Hello, E. Frank.
Yes, good morning, Frank. I'm calling this morning because I don't like what's going on with the mayoral race right now. I feel that both candidates are inexperienced with politics. They're not educated enough to understand the full scope of administrating an entire city. And I think that, you know, Eric Adams is falling into a situation where he is allowing and pandering to the President of the United States and saying that he needs help from Washington. You know, Frank, if presumptive Democratic nominee Eric Adams is knowledgeable enough about crime, and he was a transit police officer at one time, I think he should have the shoes enough to be able to handle himself as mayor and be able to handle the influx of problems if he does become the mayor. He will be able to deal with all this. I don't understand, Frank, why Eric Adams is asking President Biden for advice and asking President Biden to help the city of New York if he becomes mayor with this gun violence that's going on. What do you think, Frank, is really Eric Adams' objective?
Well, first of all, he wasn't asking Biden to help. I mean, but he was invited by Biden along with a lot of other public officials and mayors from around and police commissioners from around the city, from around the country, to the White House for a summit on gun violence. Now, I think by the president not inviting Curtis as well, he made clear where he stands. Now, Curtis would have been very respectful to the mayor, to the president, if he was invited, but he would have brought a very different perspective. What Eric Adams said, and I want to repeat everything I said to Rita Cosby last night or this morning. What Eric Adams said yesterday was so radically out of touch. Now, crime is out of control. And we saw 150 shootings in this country over one weekend, July 4th weekend. 150 shootings. And Joe Biden, President Biden, to his credit, realizes this is a problem, or his administration realizes this is a problem. And they said, hey, New York, Atlanta, Washington, D.C., Chicago, you know all that COVID money we just sent you? If you don't use it, use it to hire cops. Use it to fight crime. Eric Adams comes out yesterday and says essentially the same thing de Blasio did, which is that we're not sure if we're going to use that money to fight to hire more cops. What? What? The president is giving you a giant pot of money that you can use to hire more cops. And you're saying you're not sure if you're going to use it to hire more cops. I mean, to me, it's not only tone deaf, it's almost disqualifying. And then for him to do this demonizing, which he did again yesterday, of the Giuliani era policing on stop and frisk and the anti-crime units targeting of communities of color and this and that. For starters, he was a Republican during the Giuliani administration, at least the second term. And it's very interesting that he's kind of trying to be all things to all people now. Second, the Giuliani era, love Giuliani, hate Giuliani, you saw one of the biggest drops in crime in the history, not only of New York City, but of any city in the history of the United States of America. So if I'm Eric Adams, rather than score political points by demonizing Rudy Giuliani, what I would do is, look, maybe you don't give Giuliani credit, but what I would do is kind of what he did in the primaries. I would say we're doing exactly what Giuliani did because that worked. And there's a look, Eric Adams did say some good things, too. But the fact that he did not commit to using that money to hire more cops is astounding to me. It's astounding. And the fact that the president, who I commend for making this money available to the municipalities, didn't have Curtis Sliwa at this press conference or this summit, the Republican nominee for mayor. The fact that he didn't have the current mayor there, Bill de Blasio, who's responsible for some of the mismanagement that we've seen in policing, and love him or hate him, you're stuck with him for the next 6 months as mayor. And the fact that he didn't have the governor of New York State there, who, through some of the legislation that he signed, is partially responsible for the uptick in crime, it tells me this was not a serious attempt to address gun violence in this country or this city. It was politics. It was posturing. It was a way. It was window dressing. It was a dog and pony show. It was the way for the president to look like he's doing something when he's actually not doing anything. And it's not a serious attempt to address crime. That's where it stands. That's where how I saw it, E. Frank. 800-848-WABC. We'll continue with your calls next. 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
The 77 WABC mobile app. Download it now.
Frank Morano. Frank Morano Show.
Well, thank you, Andy. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I am Frank Morano. 1-800-848-WABC. I see those of you on hold. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. Next hour, we'll talk a little bit about baseball and some of the controversies that are jumping from the sports page to the front page, and there are many. But I do have to acknowledge this might not necessarily be a sports issue, but it's certainly a sports entertainment issue. I have to acknowledge the passing of Mr. Wonderful, Paul Orndorff, a phenomenal professional wrestler and one of the few professional wrestlers that's in all three wrestling halls of fame. You have the big one is the WWE Hall of Fame, but he's also in the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame and something called the Frank Gotch Luthez Hall of Fame, which is primarily for wrestlers with an amateur background who've had a strong influence on professional wrestling. He's also, I think, in some college Hall of Fame for his incredible work as a college football player. He was a running back at the University of Tampa. Now, he's probably best known by wrestling fans these days for his feuds with Hulk Hogan. Back in the 1980s, he was a great bad guy. They call it a heel in wrestling. And he was when you're a kid, you always sort of fantasize about being a wrestler yourself. And my gimmick as a wrestler was going to be basically his. Obviously, I knew I was never going to have the physique of a Paul Orndorff. Probably had one of the greatest physiques of any wrestler of all time, and died at the age of 71. Which is, unfortunately, that's a pretty good age to live to as a wrestler. He was announced that he had dementia recently. I don't know if that was tied to his death, but certainly a shame. And as a heel, I loved the promos that he used to cut alongside his manager, Bobby the Brain Heenan, especially when he was feuding with Hulk Hogan.
And you're lucky he's not a racehorse. He'd win the Belmont and the Kentucky Derby also, because he's the greatest athlete today. And he's the only man that ever left the champion of the world, Hulk Hogan, lane. And he has a simple name, just Mr. Wonderful. And here he comes.
You know, Bobby, some people would say just what you've just said to everybody out there, that that would be bragging. That would just be thinking that you're cocky. But you know something? That's exactly right. The truth really hurts. Because Hulk Hogan, I have earned respect. I deserve respect. I was drafted in the NFL. I was in the College Football Hall of Fame. High School All-American. The greatest athlete to ever come out of the state of Florida. I've earned it. I deserve to be the next World Heavyweight Champion. You see, Hulk Hogan, the difference between you and I is that I'll do anything at any cost to get something I want. I'll even sell my own family down the river for one reason. And that's our world anyway built. You see something? I left you laying right in the middle of the rain. Right then I left you because you thought that I was your friend. Friend. You're really dumb. Because Hulk Hogan, I've got you running wild right now. You're on the razor's edge, the point of no return. Sooner or later, Hogan, you're going to have to be man enough to sign your name to a contract. And then I'm going to be the champion.
So his son, Travis, when he announced this, he said, it's with great – and by the way, if you're not familiar with wrestling, that's all shtick. It's all an act. It's all part of the – he didn't really feel that way about the fans or his family or Hulk Hogan. But the son wrote, it's with great sadness that I announce the passing of my father, Paul Orndorff. He's better known as Mr. Wonderful. Most of you will remember him for his physique. Many will remember his intensity. But if I can only get you to understand and see his heart, he will always be Pop, Pawpaw, and Daddy at home. And as much as many of you hated him as a wrestler, he absolutely loved you for it. He was an amazing father that showed me more love than I ever deserved. I love you, Daddy. So very, very sad. Wishing the best to his family, to his friends, to his colleagues, and to all the fans that cheered him on and that booed him over the years. A phenomenal athlete and a great wrestler who's going to be missed. Until next hour, keep asking questions.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Summer, I do, and one of the great things about summer, one of the things that makes summer feel like summer is baseball. They call them the boys of summer for a reason. There's just something that goes hand in hand with baseball, playing it and watching it along with summer. The entirety of summer is consumed with baseball games. There's baseball just about every day. It's a fun time, and right now, this week, we are smack dab halfway right in the middle of the baseball season. And it's a fun time because you kind of get a sense of where all the individual players are going to end up statistic-wise. If someone's got 25 home runs, all right, they're on pace to hit 50. If a team's lost 50 games, all right, they're on pace to lose 100 games. You have the fun of the home run derby. Again, congratulations to Pete Alonso. You have the fun of the All-Star game, which apparently nobody else cares about except for Joe Nolan and me at this point. But it's a fun midway point to look at baseball. And we're going to do that a little bit this hour. But you can't, as you saw with the whole fervor over the All-Star game, I was talking about this with Brian Kilmeade yesterday, with them deciding to move it out of Atlanta, which was just, I mean, it's idiotic in my view. You cannot separate baseball and the history of baseball and analyzing what's happening in the world of baseball today from the history of America and what's happening in America today. And baseball and this country are inexorably linked. I don't think you could say it any better than James Earl Jones did in Field of Dreams.
Evil will come, Ray.
You're broke, Ray. You sell now or you lose everything.
The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball. America has rolled by like an army of steamrollers. It's been erased like a blackboard, rebuilt and erased again. But baseball has marked the time. This field, this game, is a part of our past, Ray. It reminds us of all that once was good, and it could be again. Oh, people will come, Ray. People will most definitely come.
Love that, James Earl Jones. So, because this is All-Star Week, and because we are halfway through the baseball season, the sports commentator Stephen A. Smith got in a little bit of hot water recently for some remarks that he made. This was on the show, on an ESPN show. He was on there with Max Kellerman, who's also a sports commentator. And I know Stephen A. Smith a little bit, not well, but I used to see him around the radio station when both 1050 ESPN and WABC, we used to be owned by the same company. We used to both be owned by Disney. But even after we were no longer both owned by Disney, we were all on the same floor, the 17th floor of Two Penn Plaza. So you'd see all the ESPN guys. So I got to know Stephen A. Smith and Max Kellerman a little bit. And both of them actually tried to be WABC talk show hosts for a time. And I actually worked with Stephen when he was trying to – and produced his show when he was trying to break into mainstream non-sports radio. So he's talking about this fellow, Shohei Ohtani. Now, if you're – somebody that has not followed baseball because you've been turned off by the politics of it or whatever. Shohei Ohtani is having one of the most remarkable seasons of any baseball player ever. He is on pace
And again, who knows what happens? Maybe the second half of his year is not as good. He is on pace to hit over 60 home runs this year. That is a level achieved by only five players in history. Babe Ruth, Roger Maris, Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire, Barry Bonds. I guess Ken Griffey Jr. also. So six. I guess it's something that's only been achieved by six players in history. But the thing that makes what Ohtani is doing so amazing is that he's also a great pitcher. Now, nobody since Babe Ruth has had this sort of home run hitting ability and this sort of pitching ability. So that's what they were talking about. They were doing a whole segment on ESPN about whether or not Ohtani is the future of baseball. And is this the kind of the player that baseball needs to sell to the rest of the world? And this is what Stephen A. Smith said. All right, we're going to get that clip for you in just a minute. But anyway, Ohtani is a great player. He plays for the Angels. He did not do as well as Pete Alonso did in that home run derby. Again, congratulations to him. And Ohtani happens to be Japanese. He's not only of Japanese descent, he's actually Japanese. He speaks primarily Japanese as his primary language. And Stephen A's comments on this have ignited quite a bit of a firestorm. And it's been quite a noteworthy 24 hours on this front for Stephen A. Smith and for ESPN. But this was what Stephen A. Smith had to say.
I'm just going to tell you where I'm coming from with this. Even though baseball is an international sport, and I totally get that, it's played in the United States and Canada. That's where Major League Baseball is being played. So when I'm looking at it, I'm looking at it from this perspective. In the United States of America, when you talk about the sport of Major League Baseball, you talk about its lack of diversity in terms of African-American players. You talk about the influx of foreign players, whether they be from Venezuela, the Dominican Republic, Japan, or anywhere else. If you are a star and you need an interpreter, that might have something to do, not everything, because there's a lot of things that go into it, but that might have something to do with your inability to ingratiate yourself with that young demographic to attract them to the sport. I would remind you, Max, I would remind my brother Jeff, I would remind others that baseball is in trouble. The audience for Major League Baseball, the demographic repeatedly gets older. It's not getting younger. That younger demographic, which is the target for all of the advertisers and sponsors and everybody else out there, that's the NBA and the NFL. Major League Baseball is struggling miserably. That's why you got a lot of people that have turned against the commissioner, Rob Manfred, because of all the changes that he's tried to incorporate and implement in an effort to save the sport by elevating its level of interest, okay? And it's even alienated some of the players who are traditionalists and want things to remain the same as they always were. We all know that baseball, the sport of baseball, led by its players, are always the last to the party. Always the last of the party. They're so reluctant to change. They're always the last of the party. When I look at Ohtani, he is big time. Babe Ruth, 33 home runs, batting 279. Got a 4-1 record with a 379 ERA as a pitcher. This brother is special. Make no mistake about it. But the fact that you got a foreign player that doesn't speak English, that needs an interpreter, believe it or not, I think contributes to harming the game to some degree when that's your box office appeal. It needs to be somebody like Bryce Harper, Mike Trout, those guys. And unfortunately, at this moment in time, that's not the case.
So, do you understand what he's saying there? What Stephen A. Smith said there, I find difficult to argue with, okay? He's saying baseball, Major League Baseball, it's played all over the world, but Major League Baseball is a game that's primarily played in the United States and Canada, where the bulk of the population in those countries speaks what language? English. And so if we're going to – Ohtani's a great player, and he's not taking anything away from Ohtani. But what he's saying is he's not going to be the guy that's going to be the poster child for baseball to win back younger fans when he needs – this player needs an interpreter to speak to them. I get it. I understand. You could agree with what he's saying. You can disagree with what he's saying. But I don't think what he was saying was racist. I don't think it was xenophobic. I think it kind of makes sense. If you were a great baseball player in Japan and you spoke primarily English and there was another great baseball player that spoke primarily Japanese, who do you think younger Japanese baseball fans are more likely to want to emulate and take to? The Japanese player. I mean, to me, it's not a crazy thing that he came up with. And trust me, Stephen A. has a history of saying a lot of crazy things. So I would have no problem calling him out if he did. It makes sense what he said. Disagree? Agree? Okay. Not racist. So then he comes out. People immediately started piling on him and criticizing him and saying that what he said was anti-Japanese and xenophobic and racist. So he issues a video clarification. Now, they call this an apology, but it wasn't an apology. It was a clarification, is what he said.
My segment on Ohtani this morning on First Take, people are misinterpreting what I'm saying. I'm not talking about the state of the game. Baseball itself. Baseball's a great game, a great sport. And some of the greatest players in the world are foreign players. Tatis comes to my mind. I love this brother and what he brings to the table. And Ohtani is the second coming of Babe Ruth, okay? That's not what I was trying to say. I'm talking about the marketability and the promotion of the sport. It's exactly what Sports Illustrated essentially alluded to in their article last month when they talked about 28% of the players in Major League Baseball are foreign players. A lot of them need translators. You know, Spanish, it could be Mandarin, Japanese, the list goes on and on and on. If you are a sport trying to ingratiate yourself with the American public the way Major League Baseball is, because of the problems that you've been having to deal with in terms of improving the attractiveness of the sport, it helps that if you spoke the English language. It doesn't mean anything more than that. Baseball is a great game, but baseball's audience is significantly older than the NBA, the NFL audience, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I was talking about. Nothing more. We're only talking about Ohtani because he's phenomenal. He's going to be in the home run derby, and he's got 33 home runs with a .279 batting average. Plus, he can pitch, and he's the second coming of Babe Ruth, practically. We know it's an international sport. We know that that's great, and baseball having a global appeal that it is, fine. But in the United States, all I was saying is that when you're a superstar, if you can speak the English language, then guess what? That's going to make it that much easier and less challenging to promote the sport. That's all I was saying about anybody. Later.
100% absolutely correct. If you're able to speak the English language, you're going to have an easier time connecting with English-speaking fans. I'm sorry, but that's the truth. I mean, children that play the game of baseball in this country are more likely to take to a player that speaks English. That's all he's saying. It's nothing against Ohtani. Ohtani's having a great season. He's doing what no pitcher has done since the 1920s, the early 1920s. It's an incredible season. He's not taking anything away from Ohtani's athleticism. But then you remember who he works for, ESPN, which is owned by Disney, which is a very careful company that doesn't like controversy, even though their own history is far from free of controversy. Then, you know, they said to him, Stephen A., do you like being on TV? Do you like being on radio? Well, then the apology that you issue to the Japanese community is going to have to look a lot more sincere than that. And at 6:19 last night, Stephen A. Smith finally caved. He caved and issued the kind of lily-livered apology that the Twitter mob was waiting for 24 hours. Usually the Twitter mob doesn't have to wait this long, but he hung tight. He hung tight for a day. He lasted a day, which is more than most people last these days, except Donald Trump. Donald Trump will last a lifetime without apologizing. All right, here we go. This was the statement that Stephen A. Smith issued. First of all, he issues a lengthy statement on Twitter, and then the caption for the statement says, "I'm sincerely sorry." That's what he said. And then this is the entirety of the statement. "Let me apologize right now. As I'm watching things unfold, let me say that I never intended to offend any community, particularly the Asian community." Let me pause here. Okay. Now, why couldn't he just say, "I never intended to offend anybody"? He's got to say, "I never intended to offend any community, particularly the Asian community." Why do they need to be singled out as particularly free of intentional offense? Okay, I'll read it without commentary. "Let me apologize right now. As I'm watching things unfold, let me say that I never intended to offend any community, particularly the Asian community, and especially Shohei Ohtani himself. As an African-American keenly aware of the damage stereotyping has done to many in this country, it should have elevated my sensitivities even more. Based on my words, I failed in that regard, and it's on me and me alone. Ohtani is one of the brightest stars in all of sports. He is making a difference as it pertains to inclusiveness and leadership. I should have embraced that in my comments. Instead, I screwed up." He didn't screw up. He's apologizing for what his opinion was. Okay. "In this day and age, with all the violence being perpetrated against the Asian community, my comments, albeit unintentional, were clearly insensitive and regrettable." The violence against the Asian community? What? Come on. "There's simply no other way to put it. I'm sincerely sorry for any angst I've caused with my comments on First Take." That's the show that he was on this morning. "Again, I am sorry, and I'll happily reiterate those words more extensively tomorrow morning as well." Can you imagine what we're in store for tomorrow morning? Tomorrow or this morning? This morning is going to be just, he may have tears this morning, because if that's where we are, you know ESPN said to him, "You either apologize or you're out." You know that's what they said, or they at least implied that to him. I found that so weak. I thought his first comment was fine, so nothing wrong with it. I thought the clarification of his first comment was fine. And now for him to have to issue this sort of apology where he mentions anti-Asian violence. Are there a lot of people out there assaulting Asians that are saying, "Hey, I'm doing this for Stephen A. Smith," or "I'm doing this to oppose to preserve the integrity of Major League Baseball"? Give me a break. And then for him to play the race card as an African-American? Come on! What does being African-American have anything to do with what he said? It has nothing to do with it. African-Americans can speak English, too. It's crazy. Come on. 800-848-9222. You're welcome to comment. 800-848-WABC. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. 77 WABC.
Desire.
9. I'm Frank Morano. It's Jessica Simpson. 800-848-WABC, talking about the Stephen A. Smith incident. And now once you give the Twitter mafia an inch, they take a mile. I'm going to be talking about baseball with David Krell and the Kennedy administration and where those two things intersect in just a minute. But now the Nigerian basketball team is slamming Stephen A. Smith after his rant on First Take, in which he clearly and seemingly purposefully butchered their names following their exhibition win over Team USA. And of course, now he's going to have to apologize to them. Because once you apologize to people that are upset with something you say, then that's the domino effect. You got to apologize to everybody. The biggest mistake Imus made in the spring of 07 was bowing to the altar of Al Sharpton and, like a puppy dog, crawling on his hands and knees to go on his radio show and make a show of how sorry he was. Had he been a little more, again, I hate to use the term and insert politics into this, but had he been a little more Trumpian and just now and just said, I'm not apologizing, I think things would have turned out differently for him. Look, I think he got a better show on a better station. I think things were okay for him. But the point is still the same. Now, I think Donald Trump should apologize when he does things wrong. But I think there's a happy medium in between people who refuse to apologize for doing anything. And I'm not just talking about public figures. I'm talking about everybody. And then people who will apologize as soon as somebody tells them to do so. 800-848-9222. We'll talk with David Krell in just a minute. I have a bunch of other things I want to get to as well. But Jim is in Manhattan. Hello, Jim.
Yeah, good morning. A couple of points. You know, first, if Stephen A. Smith was white, would he be fired already? And Babe, I think Babe Ruth proves Smith's point, because the Babe wasn't a packaged brand with a PR advisor. He was a genuine, out-there personality, and people really liked him. And his personality and his home runs tremendously popularized baseball, which Ohtani isn't doing.
Well, look, it's still early in Ohtani's career. For the Babe Ruth comparison. The only reason they're making the Babe Ruth comparison is because no pitcher has hit this many home runs since Babe Ruth. So that's why they're bringing the Ruth comparison. Ruth was so transformative to the game of baseball. He was almost like what Hulk Hogan was in professional wrestling to the sport of baseball. He really transformed it. I mean, before Babe Ruth, you didn't have players hitting 60 home runs in a season or 50 home runs. You didn't have players hitting 30 home runs. The leading ball players of that era were people like Frank Home Run Baker, who'd hit 10, 11 home runs in a year. And they changed the ball. They realized fans liked home runs, and they changed the ball from the dead ball to a more lively ball so that more players would hit home runs because they wanted to attract fans. So I think it's – and as far as your first comment goes – would Smith have been fired already? I don't know. I don't know if he would have. I think there's a better chance that he would have been fired. But obviously, if you fire a prominent black commentator like Stephen A. Smith, there are always going to be allegations that there's some intentional or unintentional racial motivation behind it. So I don't know. ESPN's a strange place. They had no problem firing Rush Limbaugh when he made controversial comments about race, that's for sure. 800-848-9222. Mary is on Long Island. Hello, Mary.
Good morning. It's kind of a slippery slope discussing this for me, Frank. One thing that I honestly feel is, I don't know Stephen A. Smith that well, but I do think that what he said was a racial insult against Asian people, and all different races in this country are at each other's throats today, and it's not pretty. And sports brings people together, or it is supposed to. And, you know, he makes a comment, this player can't even speak English to the American fans. And please, I'm not being racial when I say this, but how long has it been going on that a lot of people from the Caribbean, from South America, aren't speaking English to the fans. And I didn't hear Stephen A. Smith talking about this before Ohtani came on the scene. It's just not nice. We're all at each other's throats all the time. Well, he's going to single out one person, single out a bunch of them, but you shouldn't single out anybody.
Well, look, I agree with you on the latter part of your comment that, that you know, we are all at each other's throats. But you talk about the players from the Caribbean, and it's true. There are a lot of great players from the Caribbean, and Stephen A. Smith. By the way, the fact is, look, Stephen A. Smith knows more about sports than I do, but he honestly does not know that much about baseball. And I was always amazed that when he would try and do talk shows about politics, I would have to spend hours teaching him about politics so he could sound semi-coherent for 2 hours talking about politics. And he was good because he has so much energy and such a good sense of humor. But then I would say to his colleagues over at ESPN, I would say, you know, I guess Stephen knows about sports a lot better than he knows about politics. They would all say the same thing to me. He doesn't actually know that much about sports. So I think a lot of this might actually be making up for a lack of knowledge that he has about baseball. But one of the things that he did say on the subject of Caribbean players, one of the best players in the game today is Fernando Tatis Jr. He's from the Dominican Republic. But the key difference between a player like Tatis and a player like Ohtani is that Tatis speaks English. So I don't think it's racist personally, Mary, and I appreciate your comment and your listening. I don't think it's racist to say that when you're trying to appeal to an English-speaking audience, that it helps if you can speak English. Now, you can disagree with that analysis, but I don't think it makes you racist if that's your opinion. And then, especially while you're praising all of Ohtani's incredible numbers this year. So that's kind of where I am on this. Before we get to David Krell, let me say hello to – well, let me get to David Krell here because we're already a little late, and I could tell that we're going to go down a slippery slope here if we don't get there in a hurry. 800-848-WABC.
Coming home, and now the Mets have a 2-0 lead, and on to second base goes Benny Agbayani.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. A lot of you may remember that song from the New York Mets World Series run, in which they were the National League champions 21 years ago. But the announcer that's excerpted there, Bob Murphy, was a great part of the Mets tradition and the Mets broadcast, not only in the 2000s, not only in the 90s and the 80s, but going back to the founding of the New York Mets back in 1962. Now, 1962, an incredible year for the New York Mets. And honestly, one of the things that's so incredible about it is not only was it the first year that they were in existence, not only was it National League Baseball back in New York, but it's an incredible thing that you could actually have a baseball team that was that bad. Without a doubt, the worst baseball team in history, the New York Mets of 1962, losing 120 games, a record which may never be broken. And it was the Mets, they wanted to get into the history books, and they did it in a big way. Well, now there is a fascinating new book out all about baseball in that year, politics, history, and the American culture. The book is called 1962, Baseball and America in the Time of JFK. It's written by David Krell, an accomplished journalist, author, and commentator. David joins me on the phone right now. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing great. Now, of all the years that you could pick to write about, of all the subjects that you could pick to write about, and I know you're pretty prolific on a variety of subjects, why would you pick 1962 and that era?
Well, it hadn't been done, and I originally set out to write about the Mets and the Cult 45s, later the Astros. That was the focus, and in a writing workshop, it was explained to me that books with broader topics get more readers. So when I came home that night, I Googled, and I found dozens of stories and possible storylines, people to focus on, movies, literature, television. And I said, this is a groundbreaking year. I have to split the book into two major topics, baseball and America, hence the subtitle, and mix them together. And when I went back to the workshop, it got a great response. So I knew I was on the right track.
Well, it's a terrific book. Not only have I been reading it, but when I was promoting your appearance, I heard from a number of listeners who said they've been reading it as well, and they're enjoying it as well. Now, for some people that might not be baseball fans, that might be political junkies or historians, or people that may not follow that may follow baseball but may not follow politics or things like that, there's quite a nexus between baseball and American political history at that time in the early 1960s, isn't there?
Sure, and I was just listening to the show and your statements about Stephen A. Smith, and it occurred to me as you were talking, what if Twitter existed back then? There would be such pressure on ballplayers and entertainers to take political stances that I think at some time I don't know when that time happened, but at some time it wasn't enough to just do your job. It wasn't enough to just go on the field and play. But look, people are entitled to make a living. They're entitled to take stances. Jackie Robinson didn't really take political stances until after his career. And he was very vocal about it as his career moved forward. But we've all seen the movie 42 where Branch Rickey said, don't fight with the umpire. Don't fight with other players on the field. Give it a couple of years. Let people focus on your play. Be a tough player. Be the player you can be. And as we get into the 60s, you see entertainers and sports figures begin to take political stances, not just in baseball, but Muhammad Ali is probably the greatest example.
So a lot of us remember either firsthand or through the prism of history what was happening with the Kennedy administration at that
right.
time. There was a new sense of optimism.
Sure.
He began his inaugural address by saying, ask what you can do for your country, by talking about choosing to go to the moon.
Right.
Tell me how the optimism of the Kennedy administration played out on the baseball field and what was happening in baseball at that time.
Well, the photo of Kennedy on the cover, that's him at the All-Star game. You would never get a precedent in the stands today in front of the dugout to throw out the first pitch. That's a ceremonial type of thing that happened back then. It was optimism, as you said, and it's such a contrast to what's going on today. You had Dodger Stadium debuting, this beautiful ballpark that looked that looked futuristic, modern. It's still modern. It's the third oldest ballpark in the country, but it's still modern. Third oldest major league ballpark. Kennedy vowing to go to the moon when he says at Rice University, why does Rice play Texas? We do these things because we're an adventurous people. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what gets the crowd going when he says we're going to land a man on the moon by 1970. Anything can happen. We're expanding in baseball. Washington gets a second incarnation of the Senators. Minnesota gets a team. We have Houston and New York getting a second team finally after the Dodgers and the Giants leave. So there's a spirit in the air, and there's such a unification of the country. When John Glenn goes up and becomes the first astronaut to orbit the Earth, there's a feeling that we're catching up to the Russians, that finally we're going to be a player because we were behind for so long.
And how big of a deal was that in New York at the time for National League Baseball, which had been represented for so many years by the Dodgers and Giants, to return to New York in the form of the Metropolitans?
Oh, tremendously important. You mentioned Bob Murphy. They had Bob Murphy, Lindsey Nelson, and Ralph Kiner in the broadcasting booth. They were together for several years, well into the 1970s. The Mets were optimistic. You talk about optimism. When you get off the 6 train at Yankee Stadium, Yankee fans saunter. They don't really say anything. They just saunter. Their chests are out. Their shoulders are back. They expect to win. When I take the 7 train to Citi Field, I don't have a foot off the train before I hear people chanting, "Let's go Mets." Mets fans were optimistic even at 40-120. That was their record. It was horrible. They had guys who were in the only year of their major league career. Nobody cared. Nobody cared. They had guys who were towards the end. They were way past their prime. And Mets fans just wanted something, because when the National League teams left, when the Giants and Dodgers left, there was such a void. So they were so thirsty for an outlet, because the Yankees had been the only game in town for 58, 59, 60, 61. And then you have 62 banner, you know, banner day. Yankee Stadium doesn't have banner day, mm-hmm. where people can take bed sheets and write slogans. And it was just a fun atmosphere. Anyone who was there at the time, whom I interviewed, they just said it was fun.
Well, if people are just tuning in, we're talking with David Krell. If you're interested in the 60s, whether it's baseball, political, or anything else that happened in that era, cultural, entertainment-wise, you should check out his book. It's called 1962, Baseball and America in the Time of JFK. It's no accident that the Mets loaded their team with a lot of Dodgers and Giants alumni, people like Joe Pignatano, Gil Hodges, Duke Snyder, Don Zimmer. And no accident that they picked one of the most famous New York baseball managers in history to inaugurate their team. Casey Stengel, who was, I think, 71 at the time, which would be old for a Major League Baseball manager even today. Can imagine how old it was in 1962. He might have been a little past his prime as a manager, but was certainly not past his prime when it came to being quotable.
I have the most amazing fans that I've ever seen in baseball. I've been in World Series games since 1916. I've been with enormous crowds and stadiums. I've played before 96,000, but the Mets, I'll have to say, they stick by you. They stick by you in the hotels. They're on the streets. They're carrying placards. They're going through the place. You can find them over here in right field 4 innings later. If you get a base hit, they'll be over on the left field line. They make up wonderful placards. The placards are terrific. I even have to stop and look at them. I think I made 15 mistakes this year reading the placards instead of watching the pitcher or watching the hitter to take my men out. Now I'll have to say another thing about them. They're sticking with us. We've got them from the babies up. As soon as the kid can talk, he starts to say, "Metsy, Metsy, not Papa, not Mama, Metsy, Metsy, Metsy." So that's what they are. They're now singing the kids, "Metsy, Metsy, Metsy." See, where they want food and everything.
You can't argue with a lot of Casey Stengel's commentary and his analysis of the enthusiasm of the Mets fans, and that's certainly been played out over the course of the last 60 years. I'm wondering, David, if you can kind of contrast the youth and dynamism that was taking place in the Kennedy administration at the time with the sort of agedness that the New York Mets were banking on. There were not very many young players on the Mets that year, were there?
No, Richie Ashburn, I think, was probably the biggest star. But you know, we're talking about a time, Frank, when marketing was emerging as a force. I'm sure many listeners have seen Mad Men. That underscores the decade quite nicely. Casey Stengel was there for marketing purposes. He was all over the Rheingold ads. Rheingold was the first beer sponsor for the Mets. And younger listeners may not realize why they'll watch a sportscast and see a sportscaster say the Amazons beat the Reds today 5-0 as Jacob deGrom struck out 12. That comes from the clip where Casey Stengel says amazing, 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 amazing. As I said, people just wanted something. The National League fans wanted something. And who better? I mean, just listening to the clip that you played put a smile on my face. And yeah, you had a lot of older players, like you mentioned, who were towards the end of their careers, Gil Hodges and so forth. I just think that there was a dynamism, as you say, with Kennedy. And for fans in the New York area, they embraced these young guys, these young players and the older players who, you know, maybe they deserved a shot, and they just needed to fill the roster. But, you know, for the guys I talked to, Frank, it's not like they were lovable losers, which is what the phrase that's most often applied. They said we weren't that lovable, and we didn't consider ourselves losers. We tried to go on the field and do the best we can.
Did the Mets maintain that tradition of, at least in the fans' minds and the sports writers' minds, the Brooklyn bums, the sort of lovable losers that were represented by the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 50s?
I think to a different degree, because the Dodgers were so prevalent in the National League. They won the pennant so many times. It's just that they only beat the Yankees in the World Series once. But people say to me all the time, Frank, you know, the Yankees were so dominant in the 50s. You had Mantle and you had Barra. You had all these great players. To say that the Yankees were dominant is to say that they were winning the World Series 4-0, 4-1. A couple of those World Series went seven games. So to say that they were so dominating is to really do a disservice to those National League teams, not just the Dodgers, but some of the other ones as well.
You mentioned the Reingold's beer ads, and obviously I don't know that many baseball fans could forget the Reingold's beer jingle.
Lexington to Madison and on both sides of Park, they ask for Reingold Extra Dry
before and after dark.
From Coney to Connecticut on Flatbush Avenue, from Jersey scenes way out to Queens, they sing as millions do. My beer is Reingold and dry beer, friendly, freshening, and happily dry beer. Dry means clean and it's clear. Dry means thirst-quenching beer. Join the
David, when Reingold came back in the 90s, and I think there's nowhere you can get it now, but do you know if they used that same dry beer formula of the 50s and 60s that so many Met fans, so many working class New Yorkers identified with?
Oh, gosh, I'm not aware of that, Frank, but I'll tell you, one of the things that surprised me in the research is that New York was once a major beer town. We think of Milwaukee as the center of beer, but New York had a lot of those German Jewish brewers, these German immigrants who came over and were establishing their place in the beer industry, and Reingold was certainly one of those companies.
So much of that early part of the 60s was defined by the space race. John Glenn's historic flight in Project Mercury's Friendship 7 capsule, how do you compare what he was going through and the interest in John Glenn's space mission with what we're seeing now with folks like Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos going to space?
Oh, gosh. Back then, these seven Mercury astronauts were icons. They weren't even heroes. They were icons. And to have a bunch of billionaires go into space and to have space tourism, I've been hearing about that my whole life, because people said by the year 2000, when I was a little kid in the 70s, by the year 2000, people will be taking trips to the moon. That's just a matter of financial freedom. If they're able to do that, that's fine. They're entitled to do it as long as they're not breaking any laws or regulations. But the country was unified under John Glenn. They're not unified under Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson. There was a sense of we're all in this together. There was a sense of national pride. And if Twitter, if Facebook, if Instagram, if these things existed in 1962, you would have massive protests against the space program for one reason or another.
Oh, that's for sure. Talking with David Krell, you got to check out his book, 1962, Baseball in America in the Time of JFK. It's available wherever books are sold. You could also go to David's website, davidkrell.com. That's K-R-E-L-L.com. David, the World's Fair that took place in the 1960s, what did that represent in terms of optimism for the country and in terms of hopes for the future?
Oh, gosh, it represented the future, the Space Needle, the exhibits. What would life be like in 2000? What would your homes be like? What would communication technology be like? It's available on YouTube. I think it's the first time where you had a breaking news situation. People often talk about the Kennedy assassination, but in Seattle, and they had a link to several stations on the West Coast. They had a live broadcast when the World's Fair opened, and they had live shots. They had remotes where there were reporters all throughout the fair, and there was a small plane crash that happened, and the newscaster had to deliver that news while all this optimism is going on, which is a very difficult thing to do for news people. I've been in newsrooms. I've worked as a news writer for several years. So it's very difficult to deliver that news against some very good stories. There's a delicate balance. But the Seattle World's Fair was so optimistic. Again, it was Kennedy. It was a sense of we're all in this together, that there's a civic pride, whether it's NASA, whether it's the Space Needle, we're moving forward as a country. We had 8 years relatively peaceful and prosperous under Eisenhower. He got us out of the Korean War. There were some things that were going on that he had to deal with, the Suez Canal crisis, civil rights. But generally speaking, it was a peaceful and prosperous time, and that was continuing under Kennedy.
David, we're going to have to end it there, but hopefully you'll come back soon. I want to encourage everybody to check out your book, and there's a lot of great stuff in there with respect to Hollywood as well that we didn't have a chance to get to. Hopefully we can revisit that in a future conversation.
You bet. You bet. Thank you.
Thank you. David Krell. The book is 1962, Baseball in America in the Time of JFK. If you want to comment on any portion of our discussion, you can give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. The 4 o'clock hour is an hour I always have a tough time with. It's not because I'm tired. Like the song says, I'm not tired yet. Here's the issue that I always have in the 4 o'clock hour. Because I have stuff that I had planned to talk about this hour, but there are subjects in the previous 3 hours that I didn't get to. So now that I'm seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, meaning the end of the show, approaching far too quickly, I'm wondering, do I do the stuff that I had already planned, or do I cover the stuff that I wanted to talk about earlier but didn't get to? See, this is what keeps me awake at night. Either that or the 6 or 7 cups of coffee and life change tea I'm drinking every day. But we'll see. All right. I will take your call. As I'm deciding whether to go with what I had planned or with what I have not yet gotten to, let me say hello to Pedro in the Bronx, who's been very patiently holding. Hello, Pedro.
Good morning, Frank.
Good morrow.
I wanted to make a comment on Eric Adams, but I would like to stay with baseball if you don't mind.
You can say whatever you like.
Okay, I don't disagree with Mr. Smalls. I don't think he was a racist or anything like that.
Smith, not Smalls.
Smith, rather. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
And I disagree with him with the fact that I think baseball has become very international now. Because every so often I'll listen to BBC News during the weekend, and I hear, you know, they're making the comments on American sports, and specifically baseball.
So your point is you disagree with what he's saying because baseball's an international game.
Yes, I believe that it's becoming more international. You got the Latin American players, you know, a lot of Latin American players, and you have a lot of, you know, people going to Japan and so on and so forth. So I disagree with it only in that aspect alone.
Well, I can't look. You might be right, Pedro. My only point was in discussing the story. Now, maybe you're right. Maybe Stephen A. Smith is right. You make a good case. I think Stephen A. Smith makes a good case. My only point is I thought it was a shame how he was immediately labeled as a xenophobe for expressing a point of view which I think is legitimate. And I thought it was doubly a shame that he succumbed to the pressures of his corporate overlords to apologize right away when clearly...
And I agree with that. I agree with that very much. I feel that if he would have been let go for his comment, he could have picked up any place else. But yeah. I think he was weak. He should not have buckled down.
Well, I think we're on the same page on that one, Pedro. Thank you. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. All right. Wall Street Journal this week, one of my favorite columnists, somebody that I've interviewed many times, and I consider a friend, even though because she lives in Florida, I don't get to see her that often. But she's the kind of person that if she lived in New York, I would talk to her all the time. I would see her all the time. Elizabeth Bernstein, a terrific column in the Wall Street Journal this week. Headline, "Your BS detector is rusty. Time to sharpen it. We've spent much of the pandemic isolated. As we go back out into the world, we're coming face to face with more BS." And Bernstein writes, or she asks the question, has your BS detector gotten rusty? It's understandable. We've been isolated for so long, interacting in narrow circles, often of like-minded people. We're unprepared for the assault of someone spewing false information right to our face. But detecting BS, which is, of course, shorthand for a coarser version of what Elizabeth Bernstein's grandmother used to call hogwash, is a crucial skill, also known as critical thinking, as we head back into the world. Now, I got to tell you, I think there are a lot of great skills that I have when it comes to interpersonal communications. I think I'm a very good listener. I think I'm a pretty good conversationalist. I think I'm the least judgmental person on earth. I could get along with just about anybody. And I could find common ground to talk about with just about anybody. One of the areas where I am admittedly not good is knowing if someone is telling the truth or not. Because my instinct is to believe everybody. And a while ago, I don't know what drove me to this. As a teenager, I decided that even if I knew someone was lying to me, I'm going to act as if whatever they're saying is true. And that was a very poor habit to get into, because now my brain does not even, if someone's lying to me, and sometimes, look, there are very obvious lies. If someone's lying to me, I don't even separate that in my brain than if they're telling me the truth. So I have a very poor BS detector. But John Petrocelli, who is a social psychologist and a professor of psychology at Wake Forest,
researches the causes and the consequences of BS to help improve our ability to detect and dispose of it. And his studies have found that people tend to spread BS when they feel obligated to have an opinion about something they know little about. What was I saying before about Stephen A. Smith? And when they feel they aren't going to be challenged on it. He has a new book coming out later this month. Maybe he's somebody that I should talk to. It's called The Life-Changing Science of Detecting BS, but the title is The Whole World. And according to Dr. Petrocelli, as excerpted in this Elizabeth Bernstein column, he says that some BS, such as flattery or an opinion about something inconsequential like a TV show, it serves a purpose. It connects us. But BS can often be dangerous, such as when people spread false rumors about a person or repeat information about current events that's not based on truth. I think I know some people that do both of those things. Or when they sugarcoat facts in a way that leads us to make a poor decision. Quote, imagine if you were looking to buy a home and the people who live there told you it was a great place to live, but it really wasn't. So she spoke with Dr. Petrocelli, Elizabeth Bernstein did, about who spreads, I'll call it lies rather than keep repeating BS, who spreads lies, when we're susceptible to it, and how we can confront it. And I want to invite you, I'm going to give you the highlights of the answers to her questions, but I'm going to invite you to give me your take. What is BS? 800-848-WABC. Is it different from lying? 1-800-848-9222. Why do people do it? 800-848-WABC. And why is it so difficult to detect? 800-848-9222. And I'm going to link to this column on my Facebook page at facebook.com/MoranoFan because it really is very well written, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you should read it, 800-848-9222. So according to Dr. Petrocelli, BS is when someone communicates something with little regard for the truth, genuine evidence, or established knowledge. It can be intentional. For example, if someone is trying to persuade, fit in, embellish, confuse, or simply hide the fact that they don't know what they're talking about. Maybe I'm guilty of that sometimes, although I feel like I'm pretty open about the fact when I'm talking about something that I don't know about. I tell you, I don't really know a lot about it, so I don't know that I am guilty of that. They might BS, but I think a lot of times people do it unintentionally. This is true, and it's something I didn't realize until I read this column. For instance, I posted a photo on my Facebook page, facebook.com/MoranoFan, of me drinking some Tab on Saturday night. And a guy just commented a couple hours ago. He said, well, fact, that stands for what they came out of the lab, totally artificial beverage. And I thought, wait a minute, that doesn't sound true. So I go and look it up, and it took me 8 seconds of looking it up online to find out that that was not true. It's just a myth. Now, that guy could have taken the same 8 seconds and looked it up and seen that it wasn't true. So I posted it on Facebook. I said, that's not true. Now, that guy was not trying to be intentionally misleading. It was unintentional. Sometimes we just repeat things that are untrue because we think they are true. For instance, recently, keeping with our baseball theme earlier, I was telling, I told my wife, somehow the subject, I was wearing a pinstriped suit, and somehow the subject of pinstripes comes up. We're talking about pinstripes. And I tell her that the reason the New York Yankees wear pinstripes is the same reason that I wear pinstripes, because the Yankees wanted to make Babe Ruth look thinner. And she said, I don't believe that. So what did she do? She's a very smart lady and a journalist. She goes and looks that up. Lo and behold, she was absolutely right. What I was telling her was completely incorrect. I thought it was true. I've been repeating it for 25 years. I probably have been hearing it for before that. But had I just looked it up, I would have known that wasn't true. So is BS different from lying? And again, you can weigh in if you want, 800-848-9222. According to Dr. Petrocelli, it is. The liar actually knows and cares about the truth. They need to know the truth so they can detract you from it. The BSer not only doesn't know the truth, they don't care about it. A BSer could accidentally be telling you the truth and not even know it. Why do people do it? Well, according to this column here, and according to Dr. Petrocelli, one reason is simply the obligation to have an opinion. People feel they have to have an opinion about everything, not just about big important events, but also little things like should Game of Thrones have ended when it did. This type of BS helps people develop and maintain connections. It promotes communion, societal communion, not you know, the sacrament. We do it to facilitate a social bond, to be likable and interesting. People BS in a relationship when they tell each other what they want to hear to avoid conflict or hurt feelings. Of course my mother loves you. They may also use it to help get them what they want, to conceal jealousy or their motivations or to avoid someone. And a really big motivation is to promote one's status, to get ahead, to appear knowledgeable, competent, skilled, or admired. Why is it so difficult to detect? That's the question from Elizabeth Bernstein. Here's Dr. Petrocelli's answer. People usually maintain social circles with people who are like-minded. This is where you get the echo chambers of life. When you're communicating with someone who has opinions similar to your own, you never think they're BSing. You agree with what they're saying. I see this, and this is really what attracted me to this column, because I see this in politics all the time. I see people on the left, for instance, so willing to accept left-wing commentary without even checking the facts because they agree with it. And I see the same thing with people on the right. I see a complete lack. And O'Reilly was talking about this on the Cats at Night show yesterday with Peter King and John Catsimatidis. Did a great interview. They were talking about Iran. And O'Reilly pointed out, you know, it's important to know the facts. We have to double check and not just go along with things that might support our ideology. And he's absolutely right. And I see this in politics all the time. People don't even know that the person speaking is BSing them because they agree with what they're saying. So according to Dr. Petrocelli, it's easier to detect when it doesn't align with your beliefs. Now you're in a state of skepticism. And if you don't think something is true, you're much more likely to ask further questions. You know, it's funny. Our neighbors in our neighborhood, they're very nice people. The people that live across the street from us. We went over their house on July 4th. Great people. And the one person in the couple said to me, and on the one hand, I was flattered by what she said, but on the other hand, I was a little alarmed. She said to me, now I just look at whoever you have as your lawn sign for who to vote for, and that's who I vote for. And I wanted to say, no, don't do that. What are you assuming I know what I'm talking about for? Don't make your own decisions. Don't vote based on who's on my lawn sign. So this is another question Elizabeth Bernstein asked. And I'd be curious as to your answer to this. How can we get better at detecting BS? One of the best ways is to ask questions. That's what I try to do, honestly, even though admittedly I'm not great with this. First, take a moment and process what they're saying. It's like that guy Norman who called in the first hour. Now, Norman was not trying to intentionally be misleading. I think he was just trying. He felt a lot of pressure to have an opinion, going back to earlier. When he said the reason de Blasio was going with this mask mandate is because of certain members of the city council. Well, I asked which members of the city council, and he didn't have an answer. Well, if he did, I couldn't hear because his phone was screwed up, because we now live in a culture where nobody has a landline. And he wasn't trying to be, you know, deceptive. I just think he felt a lot of pressure to have an opinion. And that's where I was, without even being conscious of it, using this Dr. Petrocelli method, asking questions. So how can we get better at detecting BS? One of the best ways is to ask questions. Take a moment and process what they're saying. It's to your advantage to get them to clarify the claim. So ask, quote, is what you are saying X? When you ask people to clarify, they'll often take a step back and think. And a lot of times they'll dial back their claim. So the first question is, what? What are you saying? What's the next question? How? How do you know that's true? How did you come to that conclusion? This forces the person, maybe for the very first time, to survey the available evidence. So I'm not going to go through the rest of this, but I do hope you'll read this. I think you might be able to read it from my Facebook page if you click the link. Usually I think the journal gives you 10 free articles a month if you're not a subscriber. But it's really, really well done. There's a lot of strategies that I'm going to try to use in my interpersonal communications with people. But I don't, you know, we'll see what happens if I'm successful. 800-848-9222. It's 1-800-848-WABC if you want to comment on that or anything else we're covering. If you want to read the article, just go to facebook.com/MoranoFan. You should like that page anyway, because we're trying to make myself a social media superstar. And it's a process. I do want to tell you, this is no BS about Trinity Rehab. Trinity Rehab is a phenomenal physical therapy facility. But it's not, when you hear the term physical therapy, there's a certain image that comes to mind. But that image is not an accurate one. It's not your father's physical therapy. It's cutting edge. It's state of the art. They have something called the EPAT machine. It's FDA approved. It's non-surgical acoustic pressure wave technology. It's similar to what's used to break up kidney stones. It breaks up scar tissue. It enhances healing and it gets rid of pain fast. It's effective for conditions like back or neck pain, tennis elbow, shoulder tendonitis, plantar fasciitis, and knee pain. In just 3 5-minute sessions, you could be virtually pain-free. No prescription needed to get started. They're all over New Jersey, open in Clifton, Paramus, Wayne, Short Hills, Emerson, East Windsor, Shrewsbury, and a brand new location in Woodbridge. Call Trinity Rehab today at 800-518-0977. That's Trinity Rehab, 800-518-0977, or trinity-rehab.com.
And just listen. All you people look at me like I'm a little girl. Well, did you ever think it'd be okay for me to step into this world? Always saying, little girl, don't step into the club. Well, I'm just trying to find out why, 'cause dancing's what I love. Oh, yeah.
This show proudly weighs in on the side of the pro-Free Britney movement. And we're playing some of her songs to that effect. And as we try to highlight some of the problems that are taking place with conservatorships all over the country. Our phone number is 800-848-9222. If you want to email me, you can do so, frank.morano, that's frank.morano, at wabcradio.com. And we're also on Twitter at Frank Morano, that's Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O. If you email me, by the way, some people that email me, good folks, great folks, anybody, almost everybody that emails me, even if they have criticism or seem like a pretty decent person, but they all have not all. Some of the people that email me have a lot of issues with spacing. And it's very jarring to read an email that doesn't have proper paragraphing. I mean, come on. 3, 4, 5 sentences? Come on, give me an enter. Give me an enter and an indentation. It's just like this clump of words. It's very distracting. So that's the only thing that I would ask. If you do email, give me some spaces. Give me some paragraphs, not just a giant clump of words. All right. Hey, I did enjoy hearing from Judy yesterday, who was having a tough time with loneliness after her husband passed away. I do hope that she takes me up on my advice to go to her local library and learn a little bit about how to get on the internet so she can connect with more people. But she did call me back and give me her number. I was thinking I might have my Aunt Camille, who I'm told has a new batch of egg salad ready for me. I was thinking I might have my Aunt Camille call her, because my Aunt Camille lost her husband too, and maybe they, you know, they can kind of hit it off a little bit. I did feel bad about Judy having such a tough time with being lonely these days. But I will tell you, one of the things that I'm going to be doing this weekend is the opposite of loneliness. And my friend Dan, who's an attorney, he's a kind of a casual acquaintance. We're friendly, I'll say. I mean, what's a friend, right? A friend these days has become someone that is on your social media accounts. That's not the case, right? Dan and I are friendly. He's been over my house. You know, we've had lunch a couple of times, but that's about the extent of it. He's come to some of my events. He's throwing this big party in the Catskills this weekend, and I've never really spent much time up there in the Catskills, and I'm looking forward to going. And he said, basically, bring anybody that you want. So it's at the beach. I think it's at a restaurant on the beach in the Catskills. But the closest hotel is the Resorts World Casino Hotel in the Catskills, which apparently does very well. I've never been up there. And that's where my wife and I are staying. I've invited a whole bunch of people to this party, which is great because since there are a lot of my friends coming, it's going to be a much better party than it otherwise would be. So I wouldn't say I'm taking over the party, but I have a significant interest in the party. And the nice thing about it is, even if in spite of the best efforts of my attendees, if it's lame, we can just go hang out at Resorts World Casino. So I have a couple of questions here, and I've consulted with some casino experts. Now, I have a gold card at M Life, which does nothing for me at the ocean. They will not tier match me at the ocean, and I still had to pay $5 to park on Saturday. It was incredibly embarrassing and incredibly insulting, I must say. But I'm wondering, and if anyone knows this, please email me, frank.moreno@wabcradio.com. Does anyone know if Resorts World will tier match me with my gold M Life card? And then do I get anything cool with that? That's number one. Number two is, it sounds like this party's kind of half at a restaurant and half a house party based on the description. Again, Dan, in his initial email, he did not do the best job with spacing. So when you don't paragraph it, I don't read the whole thing. I read how they train law students to read, or how they train you to read for the SAT, which is you read three or four sentences in each paragraph. And so a lot of people that I've invited to this party have asked me, should I bring anything? And I don't know what to tell them. I don't know what I should bring. So I'm leaning towards a bottle of something, because this way, if he doesn't serve it at the party, he can just take it home. So, but I am looking forward to going. I'm looking forward to being at the Catskills, and looking forward to staying at Resorts World, and looking forward to connecting with a lot of people that I haven't seen in a while. Now, Christian, are you coming to this thing? What's your story?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. I kind of forgot that you invited me to this party, and I was kind of intrigued.
Didn't I give you the reminder email this morning?
No, I didn't get reminder email. I'll double check. I'm curious who's going. Who's going that I know that would be – other than you and your wife, I'm assuming, who else is on the
list?
Well,
I mean, first of all, that's a pretty interesting group.
No, it's a great group. I love you guys.
We got – I'll tell you who here. Let me pull up my list here. All right. John Tobacco.
Interesting.
Date of John Tobacco, who – I don't know who that will be, but it's going to be interesting. John McDonough. Okay. Brother of John McDonough. Okay. Steve Grillo from the Howard Stern Show. Remember him? You met him at that,
yes,
that party.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Tanya Ryman, body language.
Oh, Tanya is going, okay.
So she claims. And then there are a lot of maybes, right? We got Zen Sams is a maybe. My sister-in-law Sharon is a maybe. and you know, a few other people, and a lot of other people that you don't know. Catherine Rabitis, who's my insurance salesman, okay. Who my insurance rep, does a great job. Tom and Janice, whose party we missed Saturday in New Jersey.
Okay,
they're attending, and a couple of other people. We'll see who else. And you know, it's one of those things where a lot of people, you'll probably run into people that you've met previously that you don't even realize are going. It's the social event of the summer.
I feel like I'm a maybe right now. I'm a maybe.
Yeah.
Because I have no weekend plans and this would fill that void.
That is the email. I sent an email to the maybes and I feel like that's the email that you were on. So I'm gonna resend it to you now. But yeah, I did send an email to the maybes, which I'm pretty sure you were on. So
see, my biggest thing now is because it's you know, upstate basically, right? It's, you know, that area of New York. It's, you kind of got to stay. It's not a day trip kind of thing. And the thought of spending money to stay at resorts is kind of, I don't know if I want to do
that.
That
is.
That's the thing.
Why don't you partner with one of your initial friends or something?
Well, my ex-roommate, TJ, is going on a business trip, so he will not be around, unfortunately. And I don't know if my new roommate would be game to do something like this.
All right. Well, do you have any suggestions for me on the tier matching or anything?
I do not. I wish I could be more helpful. I hope they match it. They should.
They should. Right.
I feel like, especially resorts. Resorts is not, like, big enough to be that kind of snooty. Like, it's not the
no,
it's not the ocean.
Actually.
Are they really? Okay.
They're big.
All right.
Yeah, they have a place in Vegas. They have the place in Catholic. So I reached out to Michael Traeger, who's been on this show before, who's an expert in gambling. And I asked him, do they tier match? And essentially he said, not that I know of. From the little that I know, that property has a super captive audience. They're just lucky with regard to their location and such. So I don't know. We'll see what happens, but I feel like they should. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. If you want to comment on anything we're covering. Gordon is in Ottawa. Hello, Gordon.
Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
I wanted to talk about Vladdy Guerrero, who I think, if he would make the effort to learn English, I think his opportunities to revitalize baseball would be excellent. And apparently, I just heard that he's still going through an interpreter, but his father was the same way, never spoke English.
Well, yeah, I know.
A limiting marketing move.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. I certainly don't think he's having anywhere near the season that Ohtani is having, but I think it's a good idea for everybody who works in this country to try and – or lives in this country to try and learn English.
Well, English is the language of business all over the world. Do you agree or
– Yes. Yes, I do. Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
It behooves people to learn it.
That it does. That it does, Gordon. And it's a great lesson for a lot of young people as well. All right. Just got a text message here from Larry Elder. All right. Larry Elder is going to work on coming on tomorrow. He just texted me back. He says, somebody will be in touch from my campaign team. Thank you for reaching out. So who knows? Maybe we'll hear from Larry Elder tomorrow, who may or may not be the next governor of California. And it's funny, you know, that's not the only election that Larry Elder is in. If you read Talkers Magazine, he's on the ballot to be in the Radio Hall of Fame this year. You know who else is on the ballot? Alex Bennett, who we were talking about the other night. So I like Larry Elder, and I think he's good on the radio. But I would have to vote for Alex Bennett to be in the Hall of Fame there. And I will. I think I get a vote. I think everybody gets to vote. Talkers Magazine has the article today. You can just go to talkers.com, and they have instructions on how to vote and everything. But, you know, I'd much rather see him be governor of California than to see him in the Radio Hall of Fame. 800-848-9222. It's one story that I have to bring to your attention, which I found amusing but sad at the same time. It has to do with one woman's battle to prove that she isn't dead. Okay? Now, I'm going to link to this on my Facebook page as well at facebook.com/MoranoFan. That's facebook.com/MoranoFan. And this woman, it's an article in The Guardian. This woman named Jean Pochon, and I don't believe she speaks English, otherwise I would try and get her on the show. But she was declared dead by a French court 5 years ago. And she's not dead. She's very much alive. So her passport application, this in 2016, her passport application was declined. So she was annoyed. So she assumed she must have forgotten an important piece of paperwork. Several weeks later, at a doctor's appointment, she her doctor was perplexed when his computer spat out her card that gives access to the French public health system. And it said she was dead. She'd have to pay in full for her diabetes drugs. And so then she would go, and almost anywhere she went, she would find that records showed that she was dead. And she wasn't sick or anything like that. And evidently, it's a lengthy story, and it's a sad story because this has really kind of ruined her life. But she was engaged in a legal battle with someone she had a financial dispute with. And that happens in the world of business and everything else. And so she was in court with this person, and the person she was in court with said that the reason that Ms. Pochon couldn't respond to this court hearing was because she was no longer living. But what's not clear is why the court just took this litigant's word for it. Why would they not demand some sort of proof? There's no death certificate or anything like that. And yet everybody in the country of France at this point pretty much has declared her dead. So while her case is extremely unusual, she is not the first person caught in a fight to prove that the rumors of their death have been greatly exaggerated. In 2013, an Ohio judge ruled that Donald Miller would have to stay legally deceased, even though Miller was sitting in the courtroom to hear his fate perfectly healthy. He'd been declared dead in 1994 after having disappeared in 1986, owing all sorts of money in unpaid child support. See, that's a case that I can almost understand a little bit more than this one, because at least they went to court to prove that to have him declared dead. There's nothing like that here. And then in India, a farmer named Lal Bahari spent 20 years battling to prove that he was alive between 1975 and 1994, even though he even threw himself a funeral to draw attention to his plight. And he founded an organization designed to represent others declared legally dead. And they actually gave that guy, Mr. Bahari, a Nobel Peace Prize in 2003 for his work on behalf of people that are declared wrongfully dead. So this is a sad story. This is a woman whose legal adversary could not win a legal proceeding with her alive. So she had her declared dead, and everybody just took this person's word for it, including the court. And it's very sad. It's a very sad story. So I do hope you'll read it. It's a lengthy story, and it's complicated, and it's kind of emotional, but you can check it out at facebook.com/MoranoFan. That's facebook.com/MoranoFan. Also, a lot of discussion going on in the Facebook group right now, with Dan Seidel commenting on that caller before. Listening to the 80-year-old story on the delay on the tarmac, she was very polite to Professor B-word. I don't understand why everyone has to immediately get so mean. You immediately have to call someone a name. I don't know what people get so worked up over. I would have offered the professor a cup of STFU. That stands for shut the blank up. But then that's me. Very classy, Dan. All right. Marilyn writes, reading 1962 Baseball and America in the Time of JFK now, surprised to see Krell on tonight's agenda. It's a good book and a quick read. That it is. And if you want to participate in any of the discussions about this show, just join the Facebook page, Facebook group, rather, at Morano Radio Fans and Haters. That's M-O-R-A-N-O Radio Fans and Haters. Juliet Huddy joining me at 5 o'clock to bring you some of what's in the news. Meantime, I want to wish a happy birthday to Patrick Stewart, 81 years old today. An incredible actor, probably best known for playing Captain Picard on Star Trek The Next Generation, but he played Professor X in the X-Men movies. And he's also great on Family Guy and even better on American Dad, where he plays the director of the CIA, Mr. Bullock. Actor Harrison Ford is 79 today. Isn't it interesting? Patrick Stewart is only 2 years older than Harrison Ford. It's funny. And you have Cheech Marin of Cheech and Chong fame. He is 75 years old today. And boxing champ Michael Spinks is 65. Now, Spinks was a phenomenal athlete. These days, and this is the shame of Michael Spinks, the Spinkses, Leon and Michael, are both probably best known for being defeated by Mike Tyson. But Michael Spinks was a great champion. He won world championships in two different weight classes, the undisputed light heavyweight title and then the lineal heavyweight title. I don't know how many people can say that, but I suspect it's not very many. All right. So check it out at, you know, if you want to comment on anything, 800-848-9222. That's 800-848-WABC. And in addition to the celebrities that have been born on this day, Carl Larson, a big listener of ours, it's his birthday today, as is Ashley Simonetti, Josh Dossi of the Washington Post, and my wife's cousin, Alex Fruchtman, his birthday today as well. All right. We're going to do 15 seconds of fame in just in about 5 minutes. So you can start queuing up now if you want to be heard on any subjects for 15 seconds. You want to promote something, you want to tell a joke, you want to ask a question. You'll have 15 seconds to do whatever you like at 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead. Midnight. Hey, you know who Rita Cosby's got on tonight, and you should be listening to her every night from 10 p.m. to midnight. She has on Rob O'Neill, the man who killed bin Laden. They're going to be talking about the Afghanistan situation, so that should be really interesting. I'd say I listen to Rita on my way in. And I think the show that she's doing now is probably better than any radio show that I've ever heard her do at any point in her career. And that's very sincere. For instance, Jesse Waters is doing this book tour now, and he's been on a whole bunch of different shows. He did this interview with Rita Cosby last night, which was absolutely phenomenal. And he got to show – he showed off – Rita got him to show off an aspect of his personality that I had not heard him display in any other interviews. So I thought it was pretty good. Hey, you know what state has become a hotbed of Bigfoot sightings? New York State. So in 2020, New Yorkers reported 113 Bigfoot sightings. And some of them are very credible sightings. So when you think of Bigfoot, you think of California, you think of Oklahoma, you think of, I don't know, places like New Mexico, North Dakota, Montana. You don't necessarily think of New York, but apparently New York has its fair share. And in St. Lawrence County, in a community called Messina, a gentleman there named Dean Gleason actually displayed a plaster cast of a footprint that he believes belongs to a Sasquatch. So it goes to show you, you know, New York can do anything any of these other states can do as well. All right, we're going to do 15 seconds of fame in 2 minutes. If you're new to our show and we've been seeing the ratings, we have more new listeners just about every day. If you're new to our show, that's how we end each edition of our show, where we give you 15 seconds to say whatever you want about anything. So it could be a question, could be a comment. Obviously, you know, can't be profane, and we'd appreciate it if it didn't take a shot at any of my colleagues here. But the idea is to let you – to democratize the medium of talk radio and to let you, you know, have 15 seconds of a radio show. So if you want to be heard, 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. And as always, we want to encourage you to subscribe to the podcast of this radio show. If you don't get to hear all 4 hours of it, you do want to subscribe because there's a lot of good stuff that you're missing. So all you have to do is go to iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, whatever form that you may get your podcasts on. Search The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. Click the subscribe button, and you'll automatically have this show downloaded to your phone each and every day. So we're moving up the ranks when it comes to podcast numbers. So I do hope if you're not already a subscriber, you will subscribe. Now, if you don't have any of those apps, you'll be surprised if you download them how helpful they actually are. But if you don't have any of those apps, you can just go to the website FMWABC.com, and you can catch up on any portion of the show that you may have missed. That's FMWABC.com. All right, without further ado, it's time for
The Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
All right, let's be heard for 15 seconds at least. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Ted in Connecticut, you've got 15 seconds.
Hey, Frank, love the show. Did you have a tab at the bar or a tab at the bar? A tab at the bar or a tab at the bar? Call it Radio Graffiti, WLB Combs. We want the Flory Dories. We want the Flory Dories.
Thank you, Ted. Russell in White Plains, hello.
How many shootings occurred on July 4, 2018, Frank? Hiring cops doesn't result in reducing crime, especially now that cops hesitate to do their jobs. Crime went down all around the country, even when Giuliani wasn't mayor. As far as I'm he should have been canned for that nappy head remark.
Israel is in Elmhurst. Hello.
Yes. If you use fabric softener, it cuts down on the side in laundry.
Thank you. 800-848-WABC. Leo is in Manhattan. Hello.
Hi, this is the solution how we can save the statue of Theodore Roosevelt in front of Natural History Museum.
we chop off the African American, we meld him, we make a big border and put the Indian on top of the border. That way, head of Theodore Roosevelt and the Indian's gonna be on the same level and nobody have problems.
Thank you, Leo. 800-848-9222. Gary is on Staten Island. You've got 15 seconds.
Defend the statue of Teddy Roosevelt from de Blasio. Somebody must make some effort symbolically, even if risking police arrest at the last moment, to stand up. Kudlow said he was a socialist. Hello? This is insane.
Thank you, Gary. 800-848-9222. Charles is in Queens. Hello.
Yes. Hi. We were discussing before lying and BSing. I would say I didn't hear that one word, which I think embodies all types of lies and reasons for lying. That word would be ego. I think that would apply more to men than women. For example, if you ask a man if he, a certain riddle or puzzle, even though he heard the answer before and knows the answer, some men will lie more than women would and lie and make like figure out the answer.
Thank you, Charles. 800-848-9222. Tom is in the Bronx. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to say an incredible crime. There was a guy that was riding on the back of an elephant, and he pulled off a robbery. The authorities asked the guy, well, asked the victim, what did it look like? He said, and they said, well, he wore a mask. Then they said, well, let's get to the elephant. Did the elephant have big ears or small ears? He said, I don't know anything about that because there was a big towel tied around the elephant's ears.
That's funny. It's not bad. Well, it's not funny, but it is what it is. 800-848-9222. Gordon in Canada. Hello.
Yes, Frank. David Krell's book sounds interesting, and if I could recommend something to the young men out there, is The Natural by that great American author, Bernard Malamud.
That is a fine book.
For girls.
And a great, great movie as well. 800-848-9222. Chris is in Brooklyn. Hello.
Hey, how you doing, Frank? Listen, nobody listens to Stephen A. Smith for his sports knowledge. He's always been a controversial guy. And for him to apologize kind of takes away his stick. That's my thing. All right, thank you.
Agreed. 800-848-WABC. Mike is in Brooklyn. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Listen, I'm 70 years old. I'd like you to use your platform to convince people not to cancel spandex yoga pants.
Well, look, Mike, that is an important issue, and it's one that too much of the rest of society seems to be ignoring. And you're right. That is an issue that I have been silent on for far too long, and I will be joining the fight not to cancel spandex yoga pants. Thank you, Mike. All right. Coming up tomorrow. Now, don't go anywhere because I'm sticking around for the next 90 minutes to chat with Juliet Huddy about what's in the news. Coming up tomorrow, we got Dan Moldea. We have the Stump the Audience portion of the show, which I have a new twist on tomorrow, but we'll give you an opportunity to win some prizes, so you're going to want to tune in for that. And I have some other tricks up my sleeve for tomorrow's show as well. But the WABC Early News is going to be on from 5 to 6:30. You want to stay in touch with me. In the meantime, you can email me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com. That's frank.morano@wabcradio.com. And if you email me, I'll put you on my email list. So even if you don't necessarily have anything to say to me, you can just email me and say, add me to your email list. And then I put out these emails from time to time. Then, you know, you can be added to my email list. So there's that. And of course, we have the Facebook fan group, Morano Radio Fans and Haters. Joseph writes, hey, Frank, big fan of your radio program, and I'm supporting Curtis. Why do you let Russell and Steve Manhattan talk crap about the Weekend Guy? I have to say, I did not know that Harpo Marx reference was about the fellow that's on the Weekend. How would I have known that? I mean, does he call himself Harpo Marx? I don't think so. So, I mean, no, I would not have known. I would not have done that. I thought he was actually talking about Harpo Marx. See, this goes to what I was talking about earlier. I actually believe what people say. If somebody criticizes Harpo Marx, I actually think they're talking about Harpo Marx. I didn't think that's code word for another talk show host. Of course, I would never want anybody to criticize a colleague. All right. Stay tuned for the WABC Early News with Juliet Huddy. To be continued.